Greetings! I'm your host, Jason Miles, and welcome to another episode of This is Revolution Podcast. Thank you to all of you that are watching the show tonight and not watching the NFL draft. But if you are a returning viewer or subscriber to this channel, thank you. And also, if you guys are viewers of the Red Zone, you know that my co-host, who is a diehard New England Patriots fan and has been for some time, he goes back to the Scott Zolak years. Those, was it one win Patriots years? We have one rule on the Red Zone, that is never trust a UNC quarterback. And what did the Patriots do? They went against Jason and Mac and drafted Drake May. He had all the intangibles, they say. And that means he's just a white guy that's 6'4". That's kind of what they mean. He's a big white guy. And also, if you've watched the Red Zone, the last stream was 5 hours. Can we get a shout out for a 5 hour stream? Okay. Anyway, some of that time we actually talked about sports. But if you follow Mac on any social media platform, send him your condolences. He's looking for a new team now. He texted me, not a very happy camper. Just want to throw that out there. So shout out to my brother in arms, TIR member, Mike McGinnis. Really, really going through it. Someone says only 2.5 hours have listenable audio. Wow, you're a dick. But to all the new listeners of this show, welcome. So glad to have you here. If you do like what you're seeing, please make sure to hit like and subscribe on the way out. It really helps more than you think. It's just me tonight. MT and Pascal have the evening off. I want to send a massive shout out to Pascal and MT for holding it down with the doomer of all doomers, Daniel Bessner. Great appearance on the show. If you like Daniel, he was recently on NPR this morning. So definitely check out that interview. Daniel will be back on the show in a couple weeks to talk about that article that he's interviewed on NPR on. The Rise and Fall of Hollywood. I think I called it something wrong. I don't remember the title off the top of my head. It's a longer piece in Harper's. It's the feature article, but it is really, really good. And I'm excited to talk to Daniel about that. No champagne room tonight. We're going to stay a little extra. I'm going to stay a little extra longer. I won't speak for Bill. But we're going to talk about the LA riots today. Next Monday will mark the 30th anniversary of the LA riots. For some, it was an uprising based on the Rodney King verdict. While that may have been a catalyst for the events of April 29th, I see these events as a postscript from the riots originating in Watts 27 years earlier in 1965. Even though LA had a black mayor who had served a record 8 terms in office and enough black police officers that mirrored the racial makeup of the city, race-based solutions didn't eliminate police brutality of black and brown Angelenos. Indeed, the LA riots featured a diverse police force that had no problem dispensing justice with PR-24s, the metal pipe that would be safer than the chokehold that caused death in many cases. 1965, 1992, then once again in 2020, protests against police violence haven't changed the nature of policing too much. Granted, there have been some great advancements in police training over the years, but their main function in society hasn't really differed much. While police forces are much more diverse, has this DEI of state violence made life any easier for poor and working class people who too often have to bear the brunt of this overreach? Before we end the show, we're going to show the video essay, Welcome to the Terror Dome. And I'll be watching it with all y'all and take some questions. So free champagne tonight. Champagne's on me, if you will. Please welcome friend of the show and my friend in real life And I really mean that. I want to say this before I bring this person in, because I don't think they understand how important they are to not just this show, but to me personally. I don't remember how Bill Cody reached out to me. Maybe he saw a show. I don't remember exactly. But he would take the time to talk to me in real life. We would meet for hours. And when Ben Burgess had moved down here, before he relocated to Los Angeles, actually living where Bill's district was, took care of while he worked in city council. We hung out with Bill, and it's just so easy to hang out with Bill Cody for hours. He's got stories galore. He is a funny dude, a very generous dude, and a serious dude. So please welcome my good friend and friend of show, Wild Bill Cody.
Well, thanks for the kind words, Jason. It's good to be here tonight. I'm looking at the chat, and they've already gone punk rock on us. So,
That's fine. I'm writing. I'm in the middle of writing a piece that is going to be kind of the introduction, the preface, if you will, to a book that I'll be working on with one of my friends and guest, Alexander Herbert. The working title is Raging Against the Machine, Punk Politics, Marxism, Leftism. We don't know exactly what key search words we're going to put in after the colon, but Raging Against the Machine is definitely going to be part of the title. So when we get the introduction done officially, I will be hitting you up to try to get this to one of the Rage Against the Machine people, because I feel very comfortable that you know it's someone in that group.
Oh, in Rage?
Yeah.
Well, I'm an old man, so I remember when Zach was a little kid, you know, sneaking into the punk rock places in Highland Park. You know, his dad's one of Los Four.
Really?
The famous Latino art collective.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, his dad is one of Frank Romero, and his dad are the only two that are left.
I didn't know that.
But they were like the first Latino art collective. They had a retrospective at LACMA in the 70s, and it was revolutionary at the time. You know, it's like, and that's his dad. And he used to live. He's the only one I've actually known a bit, except for the, what's the drummer's name? He used to play in Greta, which was a friend of mine's band before.
I don't know. Honestly, all I know is Zach and Tom. The other two people are bass player one and drummer two.
The drummer's amazing. The drummer's when the band took off.
They're all extremely solid musicians. They showed you that with that after Zach project, Audio Slave, that they, mm-hmm. you know, can write.
No, they can play.
Crazy good musicians. But yeah, you know, I'm definitely going to hit you up for some punk rock blurbs. And one thing we want to do different with this book is we actually want to have images of the scenes. For me, West Coast scenes, right? You know, because I'm California through and through. So I'm about to start hitting up some of my old school friends for some pictures, because we want the book. We're going to try to pitch it, see if they want to do a coffee table thing. I doubt they will, because, you know, the publisher is not that big to afford something.
You like might. That. The punk rock books are selling well. Keith Morris is getting to do a second book, and there's the one on SST, I think, did okay. I'm trying to, there's a publishing house that does a bunch of the punk rocker books.
And Bazillion?
I'll send you the name later. It's the one that Keith's on, and I should remember the name, but I don't. Oddly enough, and because I'm really bad at this, I'm going to pitch this. It looks like I have somebody helping me get my book out, which is about Hollywood in the 80s. And when it comes out, I want everybody in the chat to rush out and get it. It's My story is more going to punk rock shows, but working for John Milius and hanging out at the Groundlings and that kind of thing. So
I mean, that's still, you knew Pee Wee Herman when he was Paul.
Oh, yeah. Well, Paul's an interesting cat. Better than that, I knew Cassandra.
Ooh, if you guys don't know who he's talking about, he's talking about Elvira.
Yeah. Well, they both came out of the Groundlings Midnight shows.
But is she from L.A.?
Who?
Cassandra?
Yeah, I think Cassandra's from like Orange County or something.
Oh, no shit. Well, look, let's get back to the riots here.
Let's get back to the riots.
There's a good comment about you. This guy radiates the confidence of one who's been around. Yeah. That's Wild Bill.
Some days I can even remember him.
Here's a question I don't know if you get too often. Can you remember April 28th, 1992? Now, you were telling me about this off air. Seriously, do you remember what the mood was like on the eve of the Rodney King verdict?
Well, I just told you a story. I was in a police station the day before. I was downtown because some kids had stolen my Dodge Dart and rammed it into a police car. And so they asked me to come downtown in a not so polite way. And I got my city. Here's a little tip. If the police want you to come down and you didn't do anything wrong, call your city council person or some public official and get them to send a policeman with you, because otherwise you're in trouble. And to make a long story short, what happened was they tried to steal my car and I called and they wouldn't pick up because that's LA Police Department. And so the next day I finally called and they said, okay, we can take your report now. And I gave them my license and they go, hold on a minute. And then I get this like, stolen cars. it's like, yes, Mr. Cody. Yeah. So you want to report it stolen now? Hold on a second. And they get like, police hit and run. I was like, they transferred me like three times. And then finally the guy goes, you need to come down here. And I was like, uh-oh. So anyway, so after being in the police station, having them ask me ridiculous questions, and I told you this part, I'm going to like make it really quick.
Go for it.
But the guy that was with me, he kind of stepped back, and I was in this room downtown, and I think it must have been Parker Center back then. I don't know if the new police station was up. So it might have been Parker Center, which is about to be condos or is condos. And finished up, but I got in a shouting match with somebody. And afterwards, the policeman who took me said, can I talk to you for a minute, Mr. Cody? And I said, sure. And it's like, we did everything wrong. We made a lot of mistakes here. But in the future, if you're the only civilian in a room with 20 police officers, don't tell their captain to go fuck himself. It's like, and he had a point. I was very
bad for your health.
It was a slant six. It wasn't. Somebody put slant six. They're also a good band. The Dodge Dart, the slant six, because you could pull the slant six out and drop a bigger engine in.
Look at this guy. Look at this guy.
Yes, I am from White Trashville. You know, here's the thing. Where you grew up, where I did, right? Uh-huh. During the holidays, right? This is the big thing, right? At some point, they go, hey, you want to go out and see Bob's rebuilt engine? And when you're a young man growing up there, you don't say no because you don't want them thinking whatever about you, right?
Exactly.
So you all go out there, you all troop out there, about like 15 of you, to look at Bob's rebuilt engine. And then I would, I knew you're going to put glass packs on that. You know, I had a couple of, things to say, that meant nothing to me. And then you just stand there like 15 dudes waiting until one's brave enough to go, whoa, it's getting pretty cold out here. you're thinking in your head, well, they probably don't think I'm,
maybe that's how this show can really take off, Bill, is if we just get you on here to talk about cars. If you have an old white man talking about cars, you've legitimized yourself for some reason. And if we get you, see, someone said new header. Well,
one thing I was thinking about is like, and cause I you're going to ask me some questions. I think that's mm-hmm. the best way to go. But what a lot of younger people don't understand is like every one of my friends had their cars stolen at some point. Every one of my friends had their house burgled. I was mugged and robbed at knife point, and that wasn't like a big deal. Like everybody knew somebody like that. And the 80s, you know, it was different than it is now. And I'm not sure all the reasons we were talking. Mm-hmm. Yes, there was a rise in drug use, but we have more drug use now than we did then. You know, some people, like I said, some people have done studies on, you know, the amount of lead paint that was around at that point and how awful it was for people and things like that. I don't know, but there definitely was a lot more crime. You could just go back and look at the statistics. The murder rates in New York, Los Angeles, everywhere were much higher in the 80s and early 90s. And so there was a sense, you know, people were scared of their neighbors sometimes. And, you know, right before the riots happened, I lived in Echo Park, and you know, people would stay at our house, and we lived up on the top of a hill, and you'd hear something, they go like, is that fireworks? It's like, nah, that's gunfire. And they would always say the same thing. It's like, doesn't sound like in the movies. It's like, no, it does
not. No, it does not. No, it does not.
But that is gunfire.
Yeah, and it's very different sound.
If you lived in Echo Park, if you lived in Silver Lake, if you lived in all the quote unquote cool neighborhoods now, you were used to that, you know, and that went all the way up to the 2000s. I remember because I was talking, I did call my friend Bob Forrest. And I mean, Bob Forrest was living with his girlfriend and oddly enough, John Frusciante until he found out that he had $110,000 cash in a shoebox, and then he was able to move out. They used to live in Silver Lake by Mitchell's Arena and Sunset, and you'd go to their house and there was gunfire down there all the time. You know, it's Jeez. Just the way it was.
Well,
and that was like 99 2000.
He was so
mad when John found the 110 grand, and I said, what are you mad for, Bob? It's like, you said you wanted him to move out. He goes like, but not this way.
Was it John Frusciante's money or did he take Bob's money?
No, it was John's money.
He just saved it in a shoebox.
John's, okay, I'm sure he's not going to listen to this show, but he wouldn't. John, until he was 16 and a half, was a geek who played guitar in his bedroom. Mm-hmm. And like 6 months later, he was a rock star. He doesn't have a lot of, you know, he's never had to have a lot of social skills. So John's, you know.
Special guy.
I like John, but he's not the most, you know, if he didn't have money, he probably wouldn't make it for more than a couple of weeks.
Damn.
So, well, you know, he'd probably have an assistant or a girlfriend or something. So he'd probably be fine. Great guitar player, though. That guy can fucking play guitar.
I'm looking for one of those things, an assistant/girlfriend. So if anybody, maybe I should put a Craigslist ad out for that.
So ask
maybe me that's way better than dating apps. Just put an ad out.
Ask me some questions about the riots.
when the verdict came in, mm-hmm. where were you and what were you thinking? And did you think it was going to be Watts all over again?
Oh, yeah, we knew that.
Okay.
Well, what happened was, okay, because this part I remember, and this is the part, sometimes it's in some of these documentaries, but they really kind of don't talk about it for whatever mm-hmm. reason. But so, and we talked about this last week, I was texting you, but so when Latasha Harlins, when the Korean grocer who shot Latasha Harlins and killed her, was found guilty but given 0 days. The very same day up in Glendale, there was a UCLA student who happened to be Korean who had killed his dog. And the animal rights people were out in droves in Glendale and got the judge to give that kid something like 5 or 6 years, right? Mm-hmm. So there was a big meeting at the A&E church, at the AME church, right? Mm-hmm. Like all these people were down there and they stood in front of the cameras and said, you know, here's the deal. We'll put up with this today, but if those four cops don't go down, we're going to burn this city. So we all knew what was going to happen. And it, here's the difference between the 60s riots in Watts and this one. And you can, if you look at the pictures, right, mm-hmm. you'll see that the fires aren't the whole block. They're like at the end of the block. They nailed every thrifty drug. They nailed every Korean grocer, right? Mm-hmm. And you could look out and see it. Like, you see the pictures of the Watts riots. You see, like, the whole street is burned. Mm-hmm. They weren't going to do that this time, right? And when I say they, there was definitely an organization. Some people said it was the gangs. I mean, I wasn't involved in that part of it, but there was definitely people within the African American community, the South Central community, who were like, we're not putting up with this shit, and had planned. And so the city all knew, right? Mm-hmm. And what happened was they announced that the verdict had come down. And they held the verdict for, I don't know, 3 or 4 hours. The verdict came down in the morning, but they didn't announce it till the pretty late afternoon. Right. So everybody in the city was like, yikes, yikes, yikes. And that's the thing is like, because I went back and I watched a couple of those documentaries last week. And, you know, the Reginald Denny, who got beaten up quite badly, he was from Seattle. Right.
He's a trucker.
Yeah, he was a trucker. And then you had the Mexican-American couple. Right. Who didn't speak English. Right. Mm-hmm. None of my friends were going to be down at fucking Normandy and Florence that day. Nobody that lived in the city that was paying attention was going to be down there. Everybody was at home. Right. People went home early. And I was living in Echo Park at the top of the hill, which I was just telling you. Mm-hmm. My roommate, who's still a good friend, John, he's an editor for big films, and he was, I think he's working at 20th Century, maybe. Mm-hmm. I'm almost positive he's working on Dracula, the Coppola Dracula, if I'm not mistaken. But it might have been something else. He was like an assistant editor back when you actually cut. Anyway, he was stuck on the other side, so he went to his girlfriend's house. And I was at the top of this hill, and I'll tell you the first thing, I had just recently gotten clean and sober. Mm-hmm. And so I was an angry little ball of hate because, you know, it's like whatever, but I'm stuck at the top of the house, and John's like, I'm not crossing the city. Right. Mm-hmm. And what happened was the two original flashpoints were down by Florence. Mm-hmm. And the other one that no one ever talks about is they also set fire to a bunch of shit around City Hall and around the police station.
That's where the protest was.
Yeah. So mm-hmm. what happened was the police. So Daryl Gates pulled all the police in. Right. And there were some out on the street at the beginning, but then basically they pulled all the police in, but they did block off certain neighborhoods. So they blocked off all around Echo Park down on Sunset. So I couldn't leave my little neighborhood if I wanted to, because they wouldn't let me out. But I could look down the hill and I could see they had set fire to everything along the 101. And they had set fire to a bunch of stuff like downtown. But by the evening, all of the thrifty drugs were on fire, all of the Korean grocery stores were on fire, and I was up on a hill, and you could look out and you could see, and there's picture, you can see pictures if you look it up on YouTube, you'll see pictures of people like up on hills, and you could see all the way down to the harbor, right? And then the television's on and they're going nuts and everything. And then the other thing that people don't remember is this is before cell phones. So the phones didn't work. The phones were overloaded right away. So you couldn't call anybody, right? Like about for about 30 minutes, you could call people. And then after that, you couldn't call your friends. You couldn't call your, family in St. Louis. You couldn't call anybody.
Wow.
So all you had was your television and you could look out and see everything burning. And so that was the first night. The second day was when all the looters came out. And the looters looked different than the people who were burning shit, right? And I told you this, there was a study and I couldn't find it. I tried to find it online. They estimated that the second day, some ridiculous amount of the fires that were started by the business owners to get
Insurance,
insurance.
yeah.
But you had all this looting. Now, the meat puppets were supposed to come up and stay at my house that night. And they got through right away and they were like, "What the hell's going on up there?" And I said, "Well, I don't think you're going to be able to come to the house, right?" So they were supposed to play the next day at the Roxy, and that got canceled. And the looting was going across the city, and they brought the National Guard out. And I told you this. This is no doubt. This is exactly how it happened because you. A lot of people were listening on like public radio had kind of the best thing to listen to, right? They had some people out in the streets by that time, and they had moved all the way across Mid-Wilshire, and then suddenly the looters reached the Beverly Center, which is the edge of Beverly Hills, and the troops just came flooding out. Like
You are not tearing up the nice mall.
suddenly there were National Guard troops everywhere.
You
It's
better go to
like
Fox Hills Mall with that shit.
you are not coming into Beverly Hills. This is not happening, right? And so what I did, and this is I hightailed it over the valley because the meat puppets were playing in Santa Barbara the following night, and I figured I'd just meet up with them there. And I went and saw the meat puppets at Santa Barbara. They had, if I remember right, 51 people attended that show because all the kids in Santa Barbara were stuck. They're all, a lot of them from Los Angeles, so they were all watching the riots on television. And out of the 51, I think it was like me, two of their girlfriends, and Jason Priestley, who was the hot ticket at the time, who loved them, and like seven supermodels. And they played a version of Three Birds that went on for 35 minutes. So, everything's going to be all right with a monster guitar solo and a lot of feedback. And then afterwards, they were like, 51? We haven't had 51 since we were in high school. It's like, well, there's a riot
Mean,
going on.
there's something going on down the way in
Yeah.
LA there,
As
fellas.
Sylvester Stallone, I mean, so. Sly Stone would say, "There's a riot going on," and so that's. And then what happened is I went on the road with the meat puppets, and they convinced me to do that. And after 3 days, I wanted to kill them. And I called my roommate John. I said, "How bad is it down there?" He goes, "Well, there's a tank in the grocery store lot, but other than that, it's fine." And I drove back down, and sure enough, there was for about a month there was two dudes in a tank in the old Pioneer grocery lot, which is now a drugstore in Echo Park.
Jesus.
But yeah, go
Were
ahead.
you in LA? I don't know what year you got to LA, but were you there for the Eula Love situation? Are you familiar with that?
Which one is that one?
That happened in 79.
No, I was not living there. I was going to college. I'm old, but I'm not quite that old.
Bill's like, God damn it, Jason. I wasn't there for the gold rush either. The Eula Love situation is one that doesn't get talked about very often. And mm-hmm. it was in the one good documentary about the riots that I do actually like, the 82 to 92.
Yeah, the one you were showing the other night.
Yeah, let it burn. Let it fall. Let it all fall. They briefly mention it, but Eula Love was, sadly, she was killed. 39-year-old widow. Her husband had died 6 months earlier due to sickle cell. And they had three children, three daughters. And all she had, because she was a housewife, a homemaker, was $680 worth of Social Security checks that went to her and the children after the husband died. I think he had a union job. I'm not sure. I forget exactly what he did. She fell behind on her electric bill.
Mm-hmm.
And a person came to collect.
Right.
Years ago, you'd get a knock on the door. Hey, we're going to collect. If you don't give us certified payment of your back pay, we're going to shut the power off right now. Excuse me. And so she argued with the person, and that person left. I think she even might have even taken out a knife on him. But I know she was arguing with that person. Or she hit him with a broom, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And that guy leaves. Mm-hmm. And per the protocol of this power company at the time, whoever was running power at this point, I don't think they run power in Los Angeles anymore.
Probably not.
And so
BWP now.
Yeah, no, it wasn't even them. I couldn't tell. I can't remember the name. But anyway, part of their protocol was if you get any gruff from people, you have to call law enforcement if you get like threatened by somebody. And she lived in South Central. So she took one of her daughters to the local liquor store and got a money order for the back pay. That's all she had money for, which was $22. So new worker comes accompanied by two police officers. She's irritated that someone new is there now asking for money, and now there's cops there. Mm-hmm. So she had a boning knife in her hand, and she's yelling at the cops. And they shoot her. And what people don't talk about is there's a black cop and a white cop, and both of them unloaded their entire guns at this woman. They hit her 8 times. One shot hit her in the chest. She died. They still cuffed her dead.
Wow.
Yeah. That's 79. From 75 to 1978, the LAPD shot 278 people, and they killed 123 of them.
Jesus. Well, that's, I mean, the thing that, there's no doubt that I had it better because I was, you know, a white dude. Mm-hmm. But the city during the 80s, you felt like you were under martial law all the time. And, you know, like I told you, and there's autobiographies where the punks talk about, they used to surround the punk clubs and just beat the shit out of people.
Yes.
Just for shits and giggles, you know? Yes. And it's like, you know, I talk to people out here, it's like, they didn't arrest them? It's like, no, they're not going to, like, they beat them up and then, you know, when they can take them downtown and get them some Band-Aids? No. And, you know, it's just like, it was, and they were mostly white back then. There mm-hmm. were some black cops. And yes, the mayor was a former black cop, you know? And that was when I'm like, well, look, we got about a black mayor. It's like, but he was one of Willie Parker's boys too, just like Daryl Gates was, you know? And Daryl Gates was raising money that night in Beverly Hills because he thought he was going to be the next mayor after Bradley. And I don't know if he had a shot or not, but the fact that he could raise money meant that there were people who thought that he did. And, you know, he's, I mean, I don't, if you didn't live through it, I don't know if you can explain it, but it's like, you know, I always joked, like, you know, they always talk about, you know, low riders and they drive slow. It's like anybody that wasn't like a middle class white person drove slow and had their lights, checked their lights every day and made sure they had both lights.
Yep.
Because you didn't want to give them a reason to pull you over. You
never know? Want to give people a reason. And that, yeah. I bring up the Eula Love story, and we were mm-hmm. talking about these protests in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And this does get into my next question, but even in that video, that movie that we saw, I don't know if you watched for movie night. I don't know if you were there watching.
I watched most of it.
Okay. There's a part where one of these ex-fire department, ex-reserve police guy goes, mm-hmm. when a cop pulls over a black person, it's about control. When it pulls over a white person, it's about enforcing the law. Sir, do you know how fast you are going? Do you know why I'm pulling you over? When you pull over, mm-hmm. back, say, hey, put your hands on the steering wheel. Listen to my commands. The cops in the Eula Love situation were not charged.
Right.
There is some video footage that I was going to play. It's the audio on it is real in and out. But I will say mm-hmm. this, UCLA's film department has put up tons of public hearing footage on YouTube. Mm-hmm. And they actually have some protest footage that I've put up in a few different video essays. I think it'll be in the video essay that we'll be watching a little bit about the riots.
Mm-hmm.
When you hear this person in the video footage talking about how we shouldn't judge these officers because, A, we don't know what happened, right? This is 1979. So this mm-hmm. is way before cops have cameras, right? Even cameras in cars, right? I don't even know if that technology is there at this time. And beating up on poor people is just what they did. Like you talk about these punk shows. If you listen to anyone from the hardcore scene from Orange County to Los Angeles talk about that moment, they were all at war with the cops.
Yeah. No, there was a bond between the, you know, the early rappers and the punks because they both were getting beaten up around, you know, the early hip hop in, you know, LA. And I'd like to say I went, but I didn't. But, you know, a lot of it was down in roller rinks down in South Central. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the cops would surround the roller rink and beat the kids up. And they'd surround, you know, Perkins Palace and beat the kids up. I mean, it's just what they did. And there's another thing. Did you read that one about that? Because I think it was in that documentary about the Dalton Street. Was it Dalton Street?
Yes. Dalton Street. You can find the L.A. Times article about it because L.A. Times archived everything.
One thing they don't like talking about with some of these things, because there was one up in Malibu, too. Mm. A lot of times, you know, that was back when you could claim the property.
Mm.
If somebody was selling, you know, drugs at the apartment building, you could take the apartment building, mm-hmm. right? Even if the guy who's renting it had nothing to do with it. And they finally got rid of that in the 90s. But, you know, the cops were like, you know, busting into these places. It's like, and I'd love to find out how many times they busted in when you come, like, there's like no drugs here at all. There's like not even Advil. And they shoot and, you know, kill the owner. Like, what's that about? Because I think they probably, you know, I don't know. But I know that happened a bunch, too. And, you know, and the other thing that was weird about the riots is right after the riots, people that lived in the city, this is the first time I'd seen them smile at each other in years.
Really?
It had this weird effect. And then, you know, and then we had the earthquake. But, you know, the whole thing with Rampart, that was in the second half of the 90s, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you want to tell people a little bit about the Rampart Division? Because I don't think everybody knows about that.
Well, Rampart were these guys. They were part of the gang squad, and they were out of Rampart, and they basically became their own gang. And they were like operating like any other gang in the city. And I think, isn't that what, what's the Denzel Washington one?
Training Day.
Yeah, that's the Training Day's loosely based on Rampart.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is, that's we did a. I was once one of those hardcore far left progressives, but we during the DNC, we had a, I belonged to a group called the Direct Action Network, and we got permits, which they were mad about, and we marched outside of the ring. And we surrounded Rampart. We had to agree to give up something like 20 people to be arrested. But they had like snipers on the roof with real guns, not with the like beanbag guns. And they did not like it. And, you know, a lot changed mostly after Rampart, not as much after, you would think it would have changed after the, 92, but. The rest of the 90s cops were still pretty bad. They did start to get more. I really, it's going to sound weird, but I think the fact that it's like 80% Latino now in a city that's like over 50% Latino has actually helped. Because if for no other reason than they're part of the community, because it used to be all those white cops lived, you know, that they all lived up in Simi Valley. They weren't part of the city.
Yeah, they talk about that in that documentary that that's where a lot of law enforcement lived, and they were never going to get a fair trial there, but there was a brand new courthouse there, so they wanted to use it.
And it's like, when I was with the city council, I worked with the police a lot, and you know, the more they're a part of the community, the less likely they're gonna shoot and kill somebody. It's just the truth. And I'm not gonna get in a big debate about, you know, whether there should be policing or not policing, but if you're gonna have policing, I will say this: the better trained they are and the more part of the community they are, the less chance they're gonna do something that's
This
gonna
is
be
a
bad.
good point, and my friend Alex Herbert is watching, and we've had this conversation. Police have to work for the people, because and even I don't care how far left you think you are, in the Soviet Union, in Cuba, in China, there's law enforcement. The function might be a little different, but there's still law enforcement. Like, this is going to exist. But how they function is sometimes part of the thing, but it's just it to me it comes from such a liberal angle of, you know, they have to recognize the humanity and blah 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 blah. It's like, yeah, I get that. Totally get that. But if you have a chief of police that wants to hire head crushers, you're gonna have a whole department full of head crushers. And we're in a moment right now where everyone's complaining about break-ins.
Oh
And
yeah, well that's the thing, and you well the chat can say whatever they want. They can yell at me, but I was telling you when I was working for the city council, the same people that were out at the what was the guy from Minnesota, the marches, the protest, in 20, you know, in 2020.
oh, the George Floyd stuff.
To George Floyd stuff, and you know, all the liberal, rich, you know, people that look like me, they all marched in those things and they put their signs up. And then, right after a bunch of that happened, you know, they were calling me up and like, "Where's the cops to arrest the guy shooting off M80s on my street?" You know, it's like I thought you wanted to defund the police. It's like
Yeah,
these
why
guys
don't you
should
go
have burned
talk to
my
him?
house down, man.
Hey, you're like, it's like, why don't you go talk to him yourself?
Yeah, no, they want the police to go down there and like, you know, it's like that guy's shooting off fireworks. It's like, but last week you were like you wanted an end to the police. It's like, well, not now. I want somebody to do something, you
End of
know? It's like,
tomorrow after
yeah,
my inconvenience has been handled.
and that's just how people are. I mean, I don't judge them for it, you know, but it's, or maybe I do, but you know, like when you're in a situation like that, you make phone calls and you do the best you can, you know? And I had that one time, and it was about a guy in an RV who was homeless, mm-hmm. and it was in a very nice neighborhood, and they were very upset. And it was still during COVID, so I had the meeting out in a cul-de-sac, and they wanted the captain from Hollenbeck to show up. And I said, well, I'll talk to him, and I'll have him come down here, but you have to take those signs down before I bring him, especially the all cops are bastards one. Jesus Christ. I'm sorry. You know, it's like you don't. Your opening volley when you want somebody to help you is not, hey, by the way, I think you're a F you, and I think you're an asshole. You know, they're probably going to go, yeah, okay, you too. I'm out of here.
Yeah. Fun getting that guy. You know, I'm going to tell him, I'm going to rhyme that guy to dump his septic tank right there in front of your lawn.
Look at Three Strikes. Three Strikes was one of the worst things that ever happened to California, right? And just to let you know, it's like, okay, because I have a lot of friends who are drug addicts, right? Mm-hmm. You can get a person who's like scoring downtown on three strikes in one arrest, right? And you know who was cheerleading that? It was white Hollywood was cheerleading that. Who was the person who was the person who did all the ads that got that rammed through? Because it was voted on by the people. It was Winona Ryder, because the little girl from her
Holly
class. Santa Rosa. So they all came out, they all did benefits. And then, you know, and then later on, they're like, oh, this is horrible. And they're at the Academy Awards. And it's like, well, you voted for it. You raised money for it. But, you know, their memories are never very good when you start talking about that stuff, you know. And I got nothing against Winona Ryder. You know, it's like.
Please don't tell me you know Winona Ryder.
I don't know Winona Ryder, but one of my exes did a movie that she produced. She was I used to go out with a stylist slash costumer, and she did the what was the one where they're when Angelina Jolie won the Academy Award?
Girl Interrupted.
Yes, Winona produced that.
I didn't know that. And you haven't, and because I was gonna say, if you know Winona Ryder and you haven't hooked me up, that's fucked up. She's on the list of acceptable white women for me.
Okay, well,
it's a short list, and it's an odd one.
Yeah, well, you know, she was cute back in the day.
I'll take old Winona Ryder.
What's that?
I'll take old Winona Ryder.
Well, yeah, she used to. I did meet her a couple times because she used to date Dave Perner. Remember that?
Mm-mm. I remember Johnny Depp. Did she date Johnny Depp for a minute?
She dated Johnny Depp, and then she dated Dave Perner from Soul Asylum when he was a big deal. And they had a couple, that a long co-headlining run with Meat Puppets and Soul Asylum. And Dave's a nice enough guy, but that's when he used to sew his, I always remember Chris was just furious. He goes, he has his underwear sewn in his pants.
What?
He used to, when they were making all that money, he used to go, and he had a seamstress who would sew brand new underwear into, he wanted his pants so that they had the right enough holes in them, and then he would sew underwear in them so that nothing would fall out. And Chris was just mortified. He's like, what?
Who does Jesus. That?
And I'm like, that's... well, you know, if you have a hit, you know, if you sell 6 million records, you can sew, you know, underwear into your shorts,
you know,
too.
It's funny, you know, I'm not even going to lie, and I'm sure there's going to be some great comments when I say this. If lightning struck and I had some sort of windfall of cash,
mm-hmm.
there probably was something that's really stupid that I would do with my money as well, that I felt was like this necessity. I could see that. I could totally see myself going, oh, you know, I need to have, you know, a monthly shipment of carrots and raisins to my house on the on the 15th of every month.
No, I'm glad I never got rich, because I'll tell you what I would have done, especially, well, I probably would have killed myself back in the day, but
oh Jesus.
But in my later years, I would have bought everything from the Museum of Modern Art catalog, and I'd have a house filled with crap.
I will one up you, and I'd buy everything from the Sky Mall catalog and have a house full of stupider things. But it would have felt like they all made sense.
Well, see, that's one of the reasons people wanted to riot, was because they didn't get stuff from the Sky Mall. And I know, kids, I'm supposed to call it an uprising, but
that's fine. I don't, if it makes you feel good to say an uprising, then you keep saying whatever makes you feel good.
I just, when living through it, no one called it an uprising. Not even the people doing it.
Yeah. It, you know why I say you call it whatever you like? Because, again, I talked 65, 92, 2020. What changed? Well, tell me what changed.
In the case of the LA police,
I do want to ask you that. Let me ask you this more formally. You worked in LA city government for some years. Mm-hmm. Do you believe that police have gotten better when it comes with dealing with the public at large? Because you've seen the change. You were part of the people they fucked with. You were once told, please don't call our captain a motherfucker. Or we're going to fuck you with these batons.
Yeah, well, I do think they've gotten better. And this is coming from, I don't talk about this much, but a friend of mine was killed was murdered by the cops with a chokehold.
Jesus.
And they tried to cover it up. And he was from, he happened to be from Peru. He was actually the, according to people at UCLA, the smartest math person they ever had go through there. But he had a big cocaine problem, and he was down in El Segundo before it was all condos and hipsters like it is now, and he was naked and crazy, but they didn't need to put him in a chokehold and kill him. That was bullshit, and the fact that they tried to cover it up was bullshit. My friend Julie. She was looking at the thing, and she goes, the coroner has homicide marked down here. And they're like, what? Huh? It's like, and then they ended up giving $50,000 to his parents, and they moved back to Peru. So anyway, so the 90s weren't that great still. It's changed a lot. I think it's a hapless job. My senior lead officers, I loved. They were people who worked in the community. It's a certain type of person who wants to be a cop. And some of them are good and want to help the public, and some of them want to have power. And those people shouldn't be cops. But, there's a number of them. And, I don't absolutely know what the solution is to these things, but I do think, I've been going down to Paraguay a lot recently, and they have police everywhere, and they don't hassle with people, but they're all poor, so I don't know.
there's nothing to get from them.
Well, they don't have a lot of crime down there, like street crime.
Yeah.
Apparently they have a lot of crime in their open port, but it's like, you know, big time crime, you know? I don't know. I'm not smart enough to know what the answer is, because people say, oh, we don't need the police. But like I said, they're the first ones to call. You go down to, CD1 had a lot of, undocumented people. And whether you like my former boss or not, he was always very kind and worked very hard for the immigrant population in CD1. I don't think anybody who knows him would have denied that. But, those people, they don't call the police that often.
No, they don't.
And Usually the people who call the police and want the police to do stuff for the people who already have the power. And that goes back to like a bigger issue, you know what I mean? And I've been watching these we've talked, Haiti is a hellhole, poorest country on earth. South Africa has its own version of Cop City. Huh. Jason is hot for Laura Ingraham. Jesus
can't read
Christ,
the comments,
really?
Bill. You can't be distracted by the comments.
Anyway.
I am not, by the way. I'm sure that woman looks like a goddamn...
I thought you were more of an Aaron Burnett type, but, you know.
Laura Ingraham without all that makeup probably just looks like the Crypt Keeper, and I'm way cool off that.
Probably.
Yeah.
Most people on the news probably look like the Crypt Keeper without the makeup. what was I talking about? I can't even
see.
Remember.
You guys derailed Bill.
I mean it's. I know what I was going to say. So I've been watching stuff that's going on these campuses this week. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm obsessed with. There's the Columbia student radio station. I don't know if you know this. They've been going 24/7, and they report on everything that's going on. And then and they're a jazz station, right? So they'll have some out of breath young lady. It's like, well, yeah, this happened. And then they'll go, okay, that's our field report for now, and we're going to place a 20-minute Ornette Coleman song. And today. Today is what's her face's birthday? Ella Fitzgerald. So they've been playing some great Ella Fitzgerald in between reports on people going, the protests. But I was telling Jason before, why are the universities calling in the police?
Yeah.
For their students, they have police forces. They're their students. These students. Most of the stuff I've seen, they're not doing anything but sitting in the quad, which if they weren't holding signs about Palestine, they'd just be sitting in the quad, wouldn't they? If you've ever been to these universities, there's always people sitting in the quad. So why are they bringing the police in? Why are they making a big deal out of this? And why are they arresting kids? That's messed up to me. It's like, I don't get it. It's like that. You want to know why people don't trust the police? It's because they get hired to do stuff like that. And like I was telling you, if you look at the faces of the police down at USC last night, they did not want to be there. And I know those guys. They hate doing that. But USC is a big institution in the city, and they got a lot of power, and they were able to get the police down there. But why? I don't get it. Police should be... making sure that, people aren't robbing your house and stuff like that. That's what people want from the police.
Also, this is going to sound, you guys are going to get mad at me for saying this, but I'm okay. These kids are not ready to deal with law enforcement. And in places like Texas, these MFers can't wait to fuck these kids up. I don't know what college it was. I think it was Columbia. Someone had an empty 5-gallon water drum, not mm-hmm. a full one, an empty one. And the person that shared this image, the caption said, oh, the sound of the drum hitting off the cop's helmet was meh. And I was like, motherfucker, do you know what an empty drum feels like on a police helmet? It feels like nothing. Don't ever fucking come at somebody that's got a firearm. And a baton with an empty plastic bottle, thinking you're going to cause damage. I will say it again. If you think Cop City is for this shit, you think way too much of yourself. This ain't January 6th. Hell, this ain't even Charlottesville.
No, I mean, and that's what I said. I mean, the cops last night at USC were incredibly gentle. Which
you
is
see people
not
getting arrested. They were crying.
Which is,
the cuffs got put on.
That's not
crying.
How it would have been 30 years ago. In fact, it wasn't that way 22 years ago because they, I told you about this. The kids used to have a youth march every year in September for criminal justice down by MacArthur Park. And every year there'd be 1,000 to 2,000 of these kids. And they were, you know, punk rock socialist types. And every year the cops would beat the shit out of them. And it was sad. And they never covered it on the news or anything. It just happened. And like I said, that doesn't seem to happen in LA anymore, but I think it happens other places. And yeah, no, you, I mean,
they don't need the National Guard. They don't need you don't need no, like you say, they don't need no cops. You don't need any National Guard.
It's, and you don't need Mike Johnson or whatever the fuck his name is. You don't need him showing up with the three guys he's trying to get elected in the outer burbs of New York. You know, it's like that's I don't know. That kind of made me ill, but I watched it anyway. So what's wrong with me? but you know, so going back to the riots, I mean, it's like it did get better in LA. It's not the 80s in LA, although for whatever reason, we don't have the murder rate that we used to have, you know, and we would cut our murder rate in half if we would just not let Atlanta rappers go to the city.
I mean, I'm not, I hope this is kind of like me trying to like diss the people protesting, but you know, I've had a fair share of run-ins with law enforcement in funny 46 years of life. And I had a friend, I'll say this before I let you go, Bill. There's one more question I asked Bill. Says, I had a friend come down here.
Uh-huh.
And he's doing all right in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a joint on him. I didn't know he had a joint on him. And they wanted to go see the beach. Him and his mm-hmm. friend. And as we're walking down the street, a cop took me, and this never happens to me. I walk mm-hmm. around this city all the damn time. Mm-hmm. Cop stops me and goes, "Where are the drugs?" And I laughed.
Really?
You know, of course I'm going to laugh. I'm the most boringest, straightest person around. Right? This uh-huh. pee is liquid gold. You want to pass a drug test? I got you covered. Right? 46 uh-huh. years of you know, drug, alcohol, free pee.
Right?
Right? So he goes, "Where are the drugs?" Says it again, and I'm like, no, sin drugs, you know, I'm without uh-huh. drugs. And the cop goes, "You smoked them all, didn't you?" And I'm laughing again. I'm like, I have no idea what you're talking about. And as I keep walking, and he yells, he goes, "Stop!" And he frisks me, puts his hands all through my pants. I'm like, "You fucking see?" And he gets my buddy. And he asked my buddy, "Where are drugs?" And again, I had no idea this dude had a little bit of a joint on him or a blunt on him. And the buddy goes, "I don't have anything." And he's scared.
Oh wow!
And the cop he's got it in this little holder, and the cop pulls it out and looks at it and goes, "You lied!" And they cuffed him.
Wow!
And he screamed. I had to contain laughter because I'm like, "Why are you screaming? First of all." You know, I won't get into it, but he was, you know, talking all this big shit to me about this, that, and the third. And I was like, "Why? Calm down. you're giving up too much ass right now. Calm down." And this is, you know, a huge difference between, you know, policing in the, where I live in the States. And I won't say one's better than the other. It's just different. I look at the cop and I go, "Officer, I don't have any cash on me right now, but if you just walk with me to the ATM, I can get you whatever you need to pay the fine."
Right.
I said it like that. And the cop goes, "Oh, you don't have any cash. Don't worry." And the motherfucker had a card reader in a holster.
Well, that's okay. Let me tell you. Everybody in Paraguay has a card reader, baby. It's like, it's the greatest. It's like, you know, like, it's, that's really funny. I'll tell you, I used to have run-ins with the police, and I did, I only went to jail once. And I went to jail here in Athens. And it was so bizarre, because I got pulled over, and I wasn't really drunk. I mean, I was a, they used to have a 0.75 to 1 was officer discretion, and I blew a 0.8. And to me back then, that was like, that was sober, right? I drank a lot. And they pull me over, and they like, and they help me, and they take me downtown, right? So I was here in Athens, Georgia, but I'm from Los Angeles, right? And this is back in the 80s. And so, like, the bail bondsmen, they're like, oh, fuck you. We're not, because normally it used to be you could run a credit card and they'd let you out. Mm-hmm. And they said, no, we're not taking your credit card. You live in Los Angeles. You're going to run off, right? So I had to find somebody who owned property in Athens, Clark County.
Jesus.
And back then I only knew band people, and REM happened to be in Europe. So that took away most of my friends.
Michael Stipe to the rescue. It's like,
so, you know, I was like, I'm really fucked. So I was asking, and they went to get my friend lawyer Jeff, who was a lawyer in town, and he used to have a lot of bizarre clients. So he wouldn't answer the door because people knocked on his door at 3 a.m. all the time, or whatever it was, 2 a.m. Anyway, they finally get me out. Lawyer Jeff finally bails me out. And I come walking out of the police station, which is in downtown Athens here. And it was my girlfriend, my friend Brian, and Lawyer Jeff. And the first thing, Lawyer Jeff goes, you know, I can't represent you now because I had to bail you out. I can't represent you. I'm going to have to get you another attorney. I'm like, okay. And he goes, like, she's like, this is really fucked up. And I'm like, okay, I get it. And then Susan, my girlfriend at the time, goes, and by the way, what were you doing in there? And I go, I wasn't doing anything. And she goes, you must have been doing something. And I go, why do you say that? And she goes, because they told us we had to get you out of there because you were bothering the other prisoners. And the other prisoners wanted you out. And I'm like, the other prisoners wanted me out? Where did they get off? And Brian goes, I keep telling you, Bill, here in Athens, you got to behave, right? But it's like the one time I'm in jail, and it's like the prisoner's like, we do not want to, they're like, go and fucking get this guy out of here. So I don't know what
he's trying to unionize.
Yeah. But there's another time I was driving, I'm telling way too much about myself tonight. I was on a run from Los Angeles to Seattle. And I'd done a bunch of speed right before.
Oh, you're on a drug run.
No. I was just driving because I lived up in Seattle. So I was driving home in my car, and I was just south of Portland, right? And there's lights behind me. And I always used to drive with one eye in the mirror and one eye in the back. So I saw him right away, and I pull over. And the guy comes up, and, you know, we need your driver's license. And he's like, so, Mr. Cody, do you know how fast you were going? And I said to him, I go, you know, I wasn't paying attention to the speedometer. I'm really sorry if I was going over the speed limit. And he just looks at me, shakes his head. It's like, over the speed limit? And I go, I assume that's why you're pulling me over. He goes, dude, we've been following you for 4 miles. You never got above 3 miles an hour. He said, we need you to get out of the car. And I passed all the tests and everything, and they were just furious. And the one by this time, there's like 6 cops, and the one walks up to me and goes, I don't know what's going on here, but there's something wrong with you. And I'm like, and so they made me go to a Denny's and eat dinner because they couldn't prove anything, but they knew something was up. And I just remember, it's like, dude, you haven't gotten above 3 miles an hour. And I'm like, no shit.
I mean, hey, that's a hell of a sit. Just go to Denny's. You must get the moons over my hammy, though.
I think that night they wanted to do something to me. They just didn't have the ability. So I don't know if we've touched on the riot too much.
Well, I want to ask you one last question about this before we watch the video essay. And, you know, I know it's late.
And by the way, this is the video essay you did, right?
Yeah. Yep.
It's great.
Video essay I did.
By the way, if you haven't seen it, it's really good.
You did. You knew Rodney King.
Bob knew him. Bob had. He was a Celebrity Rehab.
Yeah.
And
the Bob that Bill is talking about is Bob Forrest.
Bob Forrest is a friend of mine.
Drug counselor too.
A drug counselor, and Rodney was one of his favorite people on that show, because Rodney and I'd met him a couple of times, but I didn't really know him. But the thing about Rodney King, he's just another one of those people who just wasn't meant for this earth. Mm-hmm. He was sincerely like a good person who was a drug addict and an alcoholic. And that wasn't the first time the cops beat him up either.
Oof.
Because he was huge. I mean, I don't know if you, I forget, he was like 6'4", and like, he was a big boy. So, yeah. You know, the cops, they get afraid of big guys like that. And they, back then especially, and, you know, like I said, it wasn't the first time that he'd gotten beaten up. And that's part of the reason he did some of the stuff he did with his car, because he was afraid they were going to beat him up. And, you know, I'm not going to say that it's good to drive drunk, you know, it's bad. And you need to stay off the roadways when you're under substances, because you'll hurt other people. But he wasn't a bad guy. And I think it always hurt him that he was connected to the riots, right? Mm. I'm not saying, you know, because he could just, he was one of those guys, he did things that you're supposed to do to get clean and sober, and he just couldn't do it. He would get like a year, he would get like 9 months, but he couldn't, he just couldn't make the jump. And it's really unfortunate, because who knows, you know, I mean, he's the type of guy that, you know, should have a job at the local Y, you know, sitting at the desk and welcoming people, you know? Anyway, that's what I knew about him. And it was weird having him on that show, which was a weird show, and I'm not going to, you know, I'll leave it at that. But, you know, you have these, like, you know, knuckleheads like Shifty from...
Oh, God, who still is all drugged out.
Oh, yeah, he's a mess, you know. But, you know, you'd have people like that, and then Rodney would just be sitting there, like, you know, doing the stuff they told him to do.
It's sad, because he spent much of his post-riot life as kind of a public punching bag for a lot of people, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. there are these people that, you know, had he died, I think it would have been a little different for him. But because he lived, he spoke. And when he spoke, it's almost like people were waiting for this man that I don't know why you think he's your civil rights leader all of a sudden, because he got an ass whooping, to say something profound. And to me, the words he said, and there I end the documentary with Rodney King speaking, because for me, watching it 100 times to get the cut right, I cried every time. Because here's a person that looks at his city on fire, and he definitely felt responsible for it in some capacity. And it's overwhelming. And it's, especially when you don't sign up for that.
Yeah.
And remember, people forget, the cops were like, he was still, the DA was like, he was still shell-shocked over the beating and was mm-hmm. in no shape to get on the stand. So he doesn't even testify
mm-hmm.
in the trial.
Yeah, well, you know, and that's the funny thing that you mentioned. I mean, it's I'm going to put my little L.A. hat on now, and I'm not even living there now. But, you know, I don't think most Americans know what it's like to look out your window and see your city on fire like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there was some stuff, you know, in 2020, blah, 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 but not not a city on fire, right? And what led up to it, and that the, you know, there's a certain amount of trauma that the city went through as a group. Mm-hmm. And then a year and a half later, we had the, you know, the earthquake, right? And one thing I always said, it's like, you know, you watch like, you know, and I get it, but like after 9/11, after Katrina, you know, they'd have these massive concerts and raise a bunch of money. Nobody raised money for us. Nobody gave a shit about L.A. And I'm from Seattle, and you go up there and it's like, you guys deserved it. It's like, no, we didn't. You know, nobody deserves that. I used to joke. It's like, yeah, we set the city on fire and then God punished us for it. What do you want from me?
With the 94 earthquake, or the North earthquake.
And it's like, and that was almost worse because the aftershocks went on for months. And you'd be like walking out to your car from Trader Joe's and the whole parking lot shaking. And, you know, it's just, there was a lot of, LA went through a lot in the 90s, and the rest of the country was the go-go 90s and the Clinton and the, you know, the stock market going through the roof, and, you know, and
deregulation was a happy time for a lot of people for a hot minute.
Yeah, well, that's the whole thing is I think and we'll go and we'll end with this because I don't know how long we've been doing this, but we haven't been on that long. Anyway, we were talking about, you know, late stage capitalism and what is it and whatever. Yeah. But the beginning of the end to me for the because I don't know what I am at this point. But when they started having all the stocks were for the stockholders and not for the businesses and all the deregulation that happened. I mean, it did happen under Reagan, but it really ramped up.
Oh yeah. Under Clinton.
Under Clinton. Clinton was Mr. Deregulation and some of the shit that happened, like at the end of his term, go and look at some of the stuff that got done during the, you know, that's when they got rid of, a bunch of that stuff from the 30s was during the Glass-Steagall was removed during the lame duck session while everybody was paying attention to the Bush v. Gore. And, you know, a lot of the stuff right now, the income inequality and all that stuff, you can take it back to that. And I don't know if that's late stage capitalism or what that is, but it's really, really hurt this country, in my opinion. And, you know, everybody was having such a good time, you know, but we weren't.
not at all.
If you talked to the people in LA, we would have said, no, don't do this.
Well, anyway. there's so much more we could talk about with the riots, but we're going to play this video again. I know it's late where you are.
I'm fine.
You're going to watch it with us?
Yeah, I'm going to watch it with you.
Okay. Just to let you know, Atlanta Falcons drafted Michael Penix with the
eighth pick. Oh, he's with Atlanta?
He's with Atlanta. He was my favorite.
Who's that, Romaduse?
I have no idea. Don't ask me any more draft questions. I don't want to know. I'm going to go walk. When this is all over, I'm going to go walk into my living room and watch the draft. I saw like the first four or five picks.
See, you got some smart people here. Glass-Steagall had been really gutted before the full repeal.
You're yes, probably right, 94. Still, it starts in 94.
Yeah, but it's all—it's still all Clinton and all.
It is all Clinton.
And then what's his face who became the head of Harvard? Anyway.
Adunze went to the bit. Why would you do that? Hey, I'm going to go watch this over there. And you guys are going to be like, no, we're going to be douchers.
Well, you know, they're my huskies, so.
Dr. Claw?
It's my fault. It's my fault.
It's effed up, man. God damn. Why are you guys? Everybody wants to tell me. Okay, look. I'll say it again. Get in your DeLoreans and pretend it's 1994. No, let's pretend it's 92. And my grandma just recorded the draft for me day one, and I want to watch the draft with excitement. So don't, I'm telling this to all the people watching. So don't tell me who went where. Don't tell me about any trades. because I want to see it. See. So we're going to pretend that I have a VHS. And
well, you know.
Says Minnesota drafted Larry Summers. And a doucher to be named later. That's pretty good. You guys are pretty good for that one. But let's check this out. I know maybe some of you saw this when it premiered about 2 years ago. But if not, this is a video essay I did called Welcome to the Terror Dome. And Chuck D never retweeted it. Motherfucker. But anyway, just kidding. Check it out. I started off with the Oprah Winfrey Show. So you can get an idea of the feeling of the nation in the year of our Lord.
The jurors had seen, I'm paraphrasing, of course, the jurors had seen a Rodney King as their brother or their father, the verdict perhaps would have been different. Yes, yes, ma'am, you wanted to say what?
I just wanted to say I'm for the verdict. I'm not condoning what the officers did. I think they got a little bit of out of hand, of course. But listen. Okay, I'm telling you, we did not see the first 60 seconds of that video. We did not. No. Did you go? No, listen. The media. Listen to me.
Everybody?
The media is our number one influencing agent. And that's all we saw was what the media decided to put up on that screen. Exactly. But what did they show? They just showed that first 21 seconds, and that was it. What else did we see? Were you guys at the trial? Did you see the evidence? That prosecuting attorney, that defense attorney got to choose.
What do you mean? That did not give them the cause to beat him. They would have killed him.
I'm not condoning their behavior. I'm condoning the verdict.
This has been going on way before they showed it on the video.
Ladies and gentlemen,
the defense attorney and the prosecuting attorney had a choice of what jury they decided to put up there.
To cause him to get beat like that before you even seen it on the video. What did he do to justify
the beating like he got? And they're saying he's not a dangerous man who drives 80 miles per hour in a residential.
Okay.
The Rodney King videotape had given Black America the visual proof that we live in a society with a two-tier justice system. As the video made the rounds of a burgeoning 24-hour news cycle, hungry for content, pundits and activists deployed the discourse of racial grievance to sell policies framed in terms of transparency and anti-racism. Yet, there was a curious disconnect between this discourse and the reality of what happened.
You're going from call to call, and you're always waiting for that real big thing to happen that's going to scare the shit out of you.
What's going on?
We got a shooting victim at the rear of probably one of the roughest areas in Inglewood. It's a real death trap in there, so you really got to be conscious, safety conscious, of what the hell you're doing when you go in there. Stand by just a second. Watch those guys over there. What are you doing, dude? Okay. What happened, partner?
I mean, were some dudes chasing you? Did you pull a robbery and get shot by somebody or what? No.
Jameson, sir, I just can't place it, man. I'm walking, I'm moving.
Just all got anything that can help us at all? How many dudes? What kinds of weapons? Did you hear automatic weapons? Did you hear anything? Or do you care? I didn't think you did. The lowest of the low are just as interesting and important to the community as the guy that's got all the big bucks. And all these little businessmen right now, they're being raped by these idiots. What's your gun? Come out here. Come on. Sit down on your ass as soon as you get out. Sit down on your ass as soon as you get out.
I'd like to say, Oprah, that in response to this officer right here, when most of us call the police, we do expect help to come. Uh-huh. But oftentimes that don't happen, as in my particular situation. Now, I'm a homeowner in the Chatham area, and August 31st, I was threatened by a next-door neighbor of mine whose brother just happened to be a police officer. Mm. Now, many different occasions, this person has threatened me and my family, and when we called the police, they came and had taken their side. This particular day,
And you think the reason they took the other people's side is because the brother's a police officer?
Yes, I do believe so. Mm-hmm. Now, August 31st, I was coming home with my mother to enjoy the holiday weekend with the grandchildren and so forth. And upon arriving home, this lady was standing on my property threatening my wife that she had received a letter from our attorney asking her to remove an encroaching fence and that she wasn't going to remove it. And if we touched the fence, that she was going to shoot us.
So what happened?
I called the police. I went in the house and I called 911 three times. About an hour later, they sent a police out. When the officer got there, he went to the lady's house next door. Pardon me. My mom, my wife, and myself, we went out to approach the police to tell him our side of the story.
Yeah.
The guy came down these people's stairs, searched me. I told the officer I didn't have anything, that I was the one being threatened. The officer told me to step over here, meaning onto her property. I said, no, officer, I don't believe that I want to do that. The guy walked up to me. He's about 230 pounds, about 6'2", grabbed me by the throat, wrestled me to the ground. At this point, I somehow got up. My mother said, officer, you didn't have to do him like this. I got up. The guy threw me back down when the other officers arrived and beat me in the back of the head. And I was bleeding everywhere. When they took me to the station, one of the older cops had asked the rest of the police to call for an ambulance. I was told 4 hours that the ambulance was coming. But when they let me out on the I-bahn, they told me, go get a damn doctor yourself. I fell out on 84th and Halsted.
And wow.
And it was awful.
So what are you?
You said that we have only two choices. We can either restrain the economy and get inflation down and tolerate more unemployment temporarily, or we can try to stimulate the economy and in the end get both more inflation and more unemployment. Now, Walter, I know there are many occasions, at least, on which you disagree with Milton. I guess this may be one of them. You would say, I gather, and I don't want to put words into your mouth, that no, we can stimulate the economy and thereby reduce unemployment without, down the road, getting both more inflation and more unemployment.
Well,
now, that is a question of fact.
That is
presumably,
a question of fact.
This kind of disagreement between you two, and there are many others of this sort, should be amenable to resolution by observation and testing and something that scientists would call proof. Is it or isn't it? And if it is, how come you're still disagreeing?
Well, yeah, let's try to disentangle that. I think empirically, I think as a matter of fact, we can show that in the recovery from the deepest recession since the Great Depression, namely the 73 to April 75, we had stimulus from tax cuts and from relatively easy money and so forth that translated not into higher prices, but into higher production and more jobs and so forth. The record of the past, of the 3 years from April 75 to April 78, pretty well shows that. The inflation rate stayed pretty steady. The rate of employment rose dramatically, and so on. Then there's the next question. And this goes more to the heart of what Milton was saying a while ago. What about the use of restrictive monetary and fiscal policy to try to squeeze inflation out of the economy? Now, there we've had...
Oh, but you've got to stop before you get to that, because let's keep the discussion orderly. Because you are saying, well, I'm going to take the first effect of the policy and not look at later effects. There is no quarrel or dispute between you and me, or between those who analyze things different ways, that the initial effects of a more expansive policy will be felt in output, not in inflation. The problem is that what you are now dealing with is a hangover from precisely those expansive policies. The argument, the scientific proposition that underlies the view I said, is that there's a difference in the time lag between the difference in the time which it takes for expansive monetary or fiscal policy to affect output and the time which it takes to affect inflation. That in the history of the United States and of countries like the United States, it has taken something like 6 to 9 months from a more expansionary policy. In 1975, it was even less than that. It's taken between 6 and 9 months on the average before a more expansionary policy affects output. It increases incomes, and to begin with, that certainly does take the form of more output and more employment. But that's a first effect. We have to carry it all the way through. At the same time, it sets in motion forces which later will come out in inflation, so that the evidence from history for the United States and countries like that is that it takes another 18 months before it comes out in inflation. So if we take those 3 years, inflation actually came down during the first year and a half of the expansion. But it came down as a result of what had happened 2 years earlier. The very monetary restraints that had produced the severe recession had a carryover, and they enabled you for an interim period of a year and a half to have both increasing employment and reduced inflation. But then, beginning in the fall of 76, December 76, you started to get the delayed effects of the more expansionary policies.
South Central Los Angeles in the late 70s was one of the many predominantly black urban inner cities that was going through deindustrialization and economic stagnation for the middle classes. As the outer suburban areas of LA were prospering thanks to the financial sector, technology industries, and real estate sector, South Central for the most part was left behind as a forgotten enclave of poverty and violent crime. Of course, the economic good times experienced elsewhere in LA did lead to some job growth. However, this tended to be in the non-union service section jobs that lacked stability or good benefits. Moreover, the end of the Bracero program in 1965 resulted in the emergence of a vast reserve army of labor made up of the undocumented who end up taking many of the unskilled jobs. As Ed Sojan notes, between 1965 and 1992, quote, more characteristically, Fordist industrial sectors in Los Angeles were wiped out entirely, and tens of thousands of well-paid, often quite senior, and to a significant extent, minority and women blue-collar workers lost their jobs in widespread layoffs and plant closures, unquote. Mid-70s inflationary spending and the rise of the neoliberal Reagan era marked a decline in social services and a population that had many of its citizens dependent on welfare and the like was ripe for the explosion of the underground economy.
Of Los Angeles than rock cocaine. Some say it has become an epidemic because what was once the rich person's drug is now within reach of the middle class and perhaps even the poor. Tonight, investigative reporter Jim Forbes has the first part of his special report on the cocaine epidemic.
Heroin, I've shot coke, I've used all sorts of other drugs. Nothing has had an effect that this has had on me.
He was a hardcore drug user for 10 years, and he's talking about cocaine, rock cocaine. These small nuggets, each packing a chemical high so powerful, users say that when smoked, it's a drug unlike any other.
It's like having an orgasm is what it's like. It's such a good feeling. It's such a euphoric feeling.
A high so compelling that young women have been known to prostitute themselves for just $3. Just to get money to buy a rock.
Some of them don't even turn it for that. They just turn it for the rock.
And a 15-minute high. A high so deluding that it eats away at the mind.
I stole from my father. More or less, he's laying on his deathbed, and I was dipping into his savings and stealing thousands at a time.
A high so demanding that it sold on streets throughout South Central Los Angeles, where it's eroding the fabric of a proud and building community.
There is no way to build up any community with this kind of a disease in that community. This is worse than AIDS, it's worse than herpes, it's worse than all other kinds of diseases. Because it's simply tearing, it's eating away, it's a cancer of the mind.
See, these people are copping right now. These people are copping dope.
This cancer is being peddled in the open, where it's not at all difficult to find. And should you be naive, innocent, or untried, pushers will find you.
There's another one standing over there. Look at him patting his hand, think he got something. But that's them, all up and down this area.
Listen carefully for a moment. You'll hear a high-pitched whistle. That was a warning, a signal to peddlers that our car was suspicious.
If they hadn't seen that camera, that other street, those guys would have sold you rocks right there.
So we placed our camera where it wasn't seen, and for 21 continuous hours, we witnessed scores of deals, day and night.
I call them stop and cop rock houses. You can pull your car up, somebody runs out to the car, sells you rocks.
Kids, often gang kids, jiggling their wares, counting their profits, over and over again. Most of that money will go into the house, where the adults stay hidden, raking in the biggest profit while remaining insulated from arrest and a long prison term.
Jesse Jackson made a very good analogy. Where there is no hope, they turn to dope.
Chilton Alphonse grew up in South Central L.A. He's on the mayor's gang task force and tries to mediate disputes between warring factions. Alphonse is also soliciting government and corporate money, hoping to fund alternatives to dope peddling. He says the streets today are much worse than in his day.
They need guidance and they need help. And it's time to stop talking about it, as has been done in the halls of our elected officials, and put the money where the mouth is.
As cheap cocaine started to flow from Mexico to California, the urban decline of South Central Los Angeles provided the perfect open-air drug market for highly addictive crack cocaine. Crack cocaine, a potent, inexpensive derivative of powder cocaine, proved to be an economic opportunity for many of the city's unemployed, disenfranchised youth, a section of society that would have, in the past World War II era, enjoyed gainful employment in the city's once great manufacturing sector. Crack, with its extraordinarily high markup and the cheap manufacturing costs of powder to crack cocaine, the amount of money to be made by the gangs is astronomical. This is the moment you start to witness a more brutal recruitment by local gangs to increase numbers to battle for profitable drug turfs. Violent drug-related crime in America peaked in 1992 with nearly 2 million violent crimes per FBI reports, compared to 1980 with just over 1 million. For cities like South Central, they saw a massive increase in murders as well. In 1987, there were 387 gang-related killings in Los Angeles County, compared to in 1986, there were only 187. The police force was unable to contain the gangs despite their vicious tactics, and the street violence often spilled over into residential homes, making victims of bystanders and families. The police, who ran afoul of citizens' constitutional rights as often as any gang member shot the wrong target, faced a crisis of legitimacy. After all, the gangs weren't wreaking havoc under the banner of keeping the peace.
There is a recklessness in today's gang wars that make even the prohibition battles of the 1920s pale by comparison. There were, in those days at least, and by the direction of crime bosses, some ground rules. Civilian deaths were to be avoided. You tried not to kill law enforcement officers. It is worse, of course, in some places than others. Among the worst of all is Los Angeles.
It's not just gangs shooting each other up, but they're shooting each other up, and they're killing an awful lot of innocent bystanders.
In my opinion, you and I can be standing out talking. Just talking, and a car is subject to drive by and blow us away.
And out of all the hundreds of people that was there, he was the only one that got shot. And not shot and hurt, but shot and killed.
This isn't West Side Story. This isn't a bunch of kids going around with zip guns. It's a bunch of sociopathic killers who have Uzi machine guns and MAC-10 machine guns.
They don't have the Saturday night specials anymore. I mean, they've got the Rolls Royce of the weapons now, some fully automatic jobs, so forth and so on.
In many cases, in many of these gangs, their involvement in narcotics and the sophisticated way in which they're distributing dope, my view is that we're looking at budding organized crime, no question about it.
They are as effective as any organized
gang or mafia, as you want to call it, I would say they're probably more effective.
We have a war. We are going to be successful. Whatever it takes, we will do it.
The police chief has put 1,000 additional police officers on the street. I'm sure it's made a dent, but even with the police chief riding around in the car, they were still shooting and killing each other out there.
If we can break the narcotic gang connection, if we can really break up the organized aspects of the gangs, disassemble them, make it a one-on-one situation where they're not very organized, I think we can do a great deal in reducing the violence.
There is an incredible lack of real appreciation for the level of violence that these people are capable of.
We've got a lot of anger out there, and we can point the fingers, but we've got kids that have grown up accustomed to this type of life, and now it's just coming to a head.
They can catch you, but they can't stop you.
The denigration of the inner city could not be contained forever, and violence soon boiled over into the more affluent communities. The result was that the LAPD launched a merciless campaign of retaliation that stoked the fire already raging in Los Angeles. In late January of 1988, 27-year-old Karen Tashima was gunned down in the posh Westwood neighborhood of Los Angeles, collateral damage of the pernicious LA gang war. Her murder became an excuse for the local security forces to ramp up assaults on the impoverished citizens of South Central. Operation Hammer would give LAPD cover to behave in a way indistinguishable from that of an occupying military force. This unofficial imposition of martial law was instituted in the name of stopping gang violence. Popular movies such as 1988's Colors show an undermanned and outgunned police force at war with an ultra-violent contingent of minority misfits. The reality was very different. LA's law enforcement was a heavily armed organization of stormtroopers trampling over civil liberties. By Operation Hammer's end, there had been 50,000 arrests, most of them for minor offenses. If the savagery of capitalism was not enough, the utter destruction wrought by law enforcement would create the breeding ground for a rebellion.
Take you out to Linda Breakstone. She's been monitoring the situation at Parker Center, where there's been a standoff between police and demonstrators for the better part of the evening here. What's happening, Linda?
Okay, here we go. Now I'm going to record this.
Okay, Paul and Ann, are you there?
We're here. Can you
go ahead, Linda?
We can hear you now. You can, let's take the camera over there and show all the protesters that are now starting to march. There was at one point a big group that came. This thing is swelling as the minutes go by. A big group that came, they started burning rags and throwing them into the street. Now we're going to go in deeper as long as our cable will let us go here. Are we back now?
Yes.
Okay, here we go. We're going to go in deeper and show you the core of this thing, what's going on. Let's go this way. They're just getting... I'm sorry, we're still hung up in our court here. They're just marching up and down the streets, and they formed a big bulkhead here at the end of the corner.
I mean, can people realize what they're doing is wrong? This is not the way to overcome racism.
And merchants in neighborhoods of every color picked through the scraps the looters had left behind. And what could they say?
There was a little 9 or 10-year-old and her mother. They were walking out with baskets full of brushes and combs and stuff like that.
And what did looters call this? They said, we're going shopping. A store overstocked for Mother's Day. Nothing left.
Why? You know? I don't know. Why? Why Korean people, why?
In black ghettos, some businesses tried this. Often, it didn't work.
It's not right! It's not right what y'all doing! I came from the ghetto, too!
And a man who had overcome all the afflictions of a blighted inner city, who had built a store that was the work of his life, saw it all come down and asked why.
You managed to wake up! Why didn't you invite me?
After the riots in 1965, more racial representation did not and could not ease the tensions of an economically ravaged city. The riots in 1992 weren't really a response to one case. They were a response to decades of economic decline compounded by police repression designed to contain the consequences of societal degeneration. Race may have been part of the story. Capitalism has always created its others. However, the main event is capitalism itself and the role of police in capitalist societies.
I just want to say, you know, can we all get along? Can we get along? Can we stop making it horrible for the older people and the kids? And I mean, we've got enough smog here in Los Angeles, let alone to deal with the setting these fires and things. It's just not right. It's not right, and it's not gonna change anything. We'll get our justice. They've won the battle, but they haven't won the war. We'll have our day in court, and that's all we want. And just I'm neutral. I love people of color. You know, I'm not like they picking me out to be. We've got to quit. We've got to quit. You know, after all, I mean, I can understand the first upset for the first 2 hours after the verdict, but to keep going on like this and to see the security guard shot on the ground, it's just not right. It's just not right because those people will never go home to their families again. And I mean, please, we can get along here. We all can get along. We just gotta, you know. I mean, we're all stuck here for a while.
So
that's a good piece, Jason.
You know, it's over. It's a rough, you know, it's a rough watch. For me, even I wasn't there. I was 6 hours north in Richmond, California. But, you know, I only knew Rodney King from Comic View and Def Jam. So he was a punchline for years. And in putting stuff like this together and doing the research, I vaguely remember him on the Rehab show, which was a bit of a humanizing portrayal of him. That end moment for me really kind of captures probably how a lot of people felt.
It was, you know, I do remember when he was, you know, I don't know if I saw it in the immediate moment because obviously TV had started already like running things to death. So I might have seen it later.
Yeah.
But I remember it did have an impact. like him speaking out. And the city did settle down a lot after that. I'm not saying it's necessarily completely because of him, because I think, you know, the city, you know, when something
National
like
Guard
that.
Helped.
What's that?
I said the National Guard helped.
Well, then the National Guard helped. And also, like, you know, it's, you know, it was an explosion, you know, it was like it was, you know, it's crazy. There's a few things that I wanted to say based on watching this. And first of all, it's a really good piece, Jason.
You did it means a lot job. Coming from you. Award-winning filmmaker. So that means a lot.
Well, no, it's really good because it, and you're trying to pack a lot in there, because things like 92 don't happen like just overnight, and a lot it led up to it, obviously. There's one thing, and somebody mentioned it. What the heck happened to, you know, roller skating turban headed guy? He was a fixture down in Venice, man. I was like, I saw that shot. I'm like, there's a documentary there. What the hell happened to him? Every time he went down to Venice, he was down there, man.
I loved that roller. There's a person that apparently was an LA resident, and they would drive around with a video camera, like a camcorder. And I don't know if they died and a family member uploaded. I don't know if it's from a storage unit. But someone uploaded all this nonsensical footage. There's no sound whatsoever. And it's just footage of a dude driving around L.A. And
they got like Angeline and.
oh, man. There's some things I found. I was like, you know, also finding UCLA. I get confused on what I made so many intros to this show. When we started doing video, I thought it was a good idea to make little commercials for the show beforehand. So I would make little videos before each show. And Gene Bajlan and Pascal, thank you so much, guys, for telling me to stop. They're like, Jason, you're running yourself ragged. So a lot of the music.
By the way, Toussaint's in the chat there.
Yeah.
Hello, Toussaint.
Toussaint is always regulating. She's always there watching. You least expect it. She's there. But there's a lot of great footage that UCLA put up that I use for things. I thought I used it for this, but I didn't. Because in the article I wrote, I do mention Eula Love as you know, one of these moments where, again, 92 doesn't happen in a vacuum of one ass whooping. In looking, I actually looked for the article, the original article in the LA Times, and it really was on page 8, I think. And it was it was a few paragraphs long. And then because of cable news, because of gossip news at the time, people forget there were shows like Current Affair and Hard Copy.
Right.
Everybody running this ass whooping, it kind of just took off. 24 He was talking about it all the time, but it wasn't that big of a story the next day in Los Angeles. In finding that article, it took me down a rabbit hole into reading the LA Times, because there was things I just wanted to find out, like, okay, what was the sentiment of people afterwards? A year after the riots, people were asked, and they broke it down by ethnicity, how they felt about police presence. And most people still wanted more cops. They didn't feel safe.
Right.
And that's an important narrative to weave in to police overreach and Daryl Gates. You said it. Daryl Gates loved being his own gang. But the people before him were like this as well.
Oh yeah, no, it all comes from, and the goddamn police station was named after Willie Parker, who he was the guy who trained all of them. And but you know, there's something else that watching that was, and unfortunately I know a bit about this. Crack was a weird thing because like the real epicenter of the crack was downtown.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a friend who he had actually been a executive at a film company. He was a vice president. He started smoking crack. Six weeks later, I went down with a friend to try and find him under the 4th Street Bridge.
Jesus Christ.
And the reason I bring this up is we got him into rehab right before the riots happened, right? And I went down. He was at this weird rehab. I don't even know if it's still there. And it was on, it was down by like 3rd and Hillhurst, which I think changes. Anyway, it's down by like Beverly, where Beverly and 3rd come together, like just next to Silver Lake. And I took him some cigarettes because, you know, that's what I did, right? And I was sitting with him and I was like looking out and they had like 10 to 15 buses, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they were just grabbing every Latino on the street. And if they didn't have an ID, they put them on the bus.
Mm-hmm.
And they drove them down and deported all of them in Jesus. Punishment for the looting. And I sat there and watched it, and my friend, I still talk to him on Facebook. I should ask him about this, because I said, what the fuck is going on there? He goes, like, they've been doing it all morning.
Damn.
And that neighborhood was Latino. And I've never heard anybody really talk about that. But they did collective punishment, because the second day, a lot of the looting was, you know, in, you know, Latino neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm.
And I watched them, and they were out there with immigration. And they were just loading them on the bus.
Damn.
And my friend said, like, if you went to get a pack of cigarettes and you left your wallet at home, you know, you were going to have to, like, be on the other side of the border calling up, can you bring my wallet to get back out again? And nobody ever talks about shit like that. And the other thing that's weird about crack, right,
mm-hmm.
that people never talk about unless you, like, new people that were involved. That was the only drug I've ever remembered mm-hmm. where you could go down there with your grandmother's couch or a washer dryer, and they would give you like rocks of crack, right? It's like you do that with regular cocaine or heroin. You show up with a washing machine, they're like, fuck off, buddy. Get some, you know, take this to the, you know,
pawn shop and go fucking
take this to the pawn shop and come back with some cash. But those dudes used to take whatever, man. You could show up down there with a TV and they're like, okay, here's two rocks and be on your way. And I don't, it was like going down to some of those places were like going down to Fred Sanford's. It's kooky. You know, I was like, the first time I saw it, I'm like, what do you mean you're going to take, you know, I would meet people and they're like, yeah, my grandmother let me stay over when she went to Mexico. She came back and everything was gone. I go, they really, and I was shocked the first time I heard it. I'm like, you can go down there with a couch? It's like, oh, a nice one, sure. Like, not a ratty one, but yeah, it's just crazy. That the whole crack thing was really, and MacArthur Park, right? Because mm-hmm. I used to go down there and look for friends in MacArthur Park. You go there at 3 a.m. and it looked like Night of the Living Dead. It would mm-hmm. just be filled with crackheads wandering around MacArthur Park. Dude,
people don't like to talk about the zombie like state, and I feel like it's worse now because less people have homes.
Well, the whole meth and fentanyl thing is really, and it's funny because I just saw a thing, and I'm trying to get an interview for this film I'm doing with this guy Sam Quinones.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know him?
Nope.
He writes he wrote about the fentanyl thing, and nobody wanted to hear from him like 10 years ago, but now he's going to be doing that. I'm doing a movie that's a little bit about happiness, but now I think it's about staying unhappy. They're doing the hearings. The feds are doing the hearings on why Americans are unhappy tomorrow with Senator Chris Murphy and some Republican senator. And but he's going to speak, and he's really great. And I'm going to probably pull that from because that's all public record, but I'm trying to get him for an interview. But I don't know what's going on with our drug overdose death rate is so much higher than the rest of the world. It's stunning. It is just shocking. And I don't know what the cause of it is. A lot of people say it's a lack of community, but I look in our chat and I see a community and I'm like, how can that be?
You know, okay, here's the thing. There's a video that's viral. It's going viral, whatever that means in 2024. And it is a cute video. And it's one of those kind of chat roulette type things. I don't know what the new one is called, where a person pops up on the screen and you talk to them. And usually it's young kids and they say mean things to each other. Go die. Go die. And there's a young kid.
Jesus.
Real mean things, right? Because it's the internet and you don't know where they are. And so I'd just be mean. It's my default. And we can get deeper into that if you want. But in this video, it's a young white kid and a younger or older, maybe like late teens, early 20s, Persian young man. I think he's Persian. And the white kid is like this. His back's kind of sideways, and he's like, hi. And he's very nervous. And he said, the last person that came on here told me to go kill myself. And the dude he's on the call with has got this great big grin, and he's like, oh, man, that's horrible. What's your name? The kid goes, like, Jesse. He goes, hey, Jesse, just, you know what? Ignore the haters. How's your day today? And he's talking to this kid, and the kid's body language changes slowly. He goes, hey, Dragon Ball Z hat or something, one of these shows that I'm too old to know. And the kid goes, yeah. He goes, oh, is that shirt a Legends of Zelda shirt? What's your favorite game? And the kid just all of a sudden, his whole attitude changed. And he ends a little, because this is real quick. It's supposed to be like a few minutes. And he ends and says, hey, man, don't listen to the haters. And you just do. Da-da-da-da-da. And, you know, all these famous people are commenting on it and, you know, heartwarming and stuff like that. And it is very cute to see this young 12-year-old boy get told 2 seconds ago to go F himself. And right after that, somebody, you know, sends rays of sunshine through the internet. But if that kid doesn't log off, he's going to get more people telling him to go fuck himself.
Well, that's the thing, is I think I'm not going to blame social media and stuff, but, you know, real relationships, I don't think, are necessarily online. And I don't know. I mean, I've immersed myself in this project and, you know, going down to Paraguay, they do seem happier, but they, one of the things they said is like, you know, if people aren't coming over your house, it's not a house, you know?
And, I mean, that's the thing. It's like, I'll be honest, I enjoy what I do. It's hard work, but it's hard work that I enjoy doing. I enjoy the community that we're building here.
Paraguay's not going to get fucked like the rest of America. They're too poor.
But, you know, when I log off, nobody's knocking on my door. I'm not having a dinner party with my internet friends. I don't know any of these people in real life.
I see your pics, though. You go out and hang out, and
I try to have a life, and I'm a weirdo that talks to strangers. I definitely talk to strangers all the time. The last dinner party I had is literally people that I met, a family that I met at a punk show down here, like a husband, wife, and their two children. And then the last time I went out, I actually was with them. We hung out in TJ with the kids and had a blast, but you know, they're also a family trying to raise children, and they have,
you know, there's some Mead kids on here trying to tell Paraguay to fuck themselves, and I don't appreciate that. Mean kids. Anyway, go ahead.
I watched that video and I thought to myself, this is really sweet. Uh-huh. But it's only really sweet if that kid turns the computer off and then just goes exists with his real friends and doesn't get beaten down by online. Because online's an MF-er. And it can change the way you see the outside world, especially. So, I don't discourage online spaces, but I definitely encourage real life meet spaces and like the live stuff we do, even when it's not like a ticket price. Just we do a thing on Valentine's Day where we just hang out, me and Ben Burgess at the Rainbow, and the single lefty dudes come hang out with us. It's actually kind of a fucking ball to hang out with real people.
Nah, it's you know, I've been fortunate here in Athens. I mean, I saw lots of people in LA because I couldn't walk down the street in Highland Park without somebody asking me to help them with something.
And Ben had his birthday party at Highland Park Bowl, and fucking blast bowling. By the way,
that's Dimitri runs that. He owns that.
So it's you're like, saying that if you would have took you, it would have been free, and I wouldn't have had to pay $134 to bowl.
I've gotten friends in there before, but there's a beautiful bowling alley. But you know that used to be Mr. T's Bowl, where Fuzzyland was.
That's where it was ghetto back in the day, right? It was
Zach like super used ghetto. To go in. Fuzzyland was this place this guy Jack Zinder ran. It is where Bob Forrest met the Chili Peppers.
And, oh, no shit.
Oh, yeah. No, Fuzzyland was the shit. And it was only like one night a week, but it was all the punks were in there. And that was one of the things. And then into the 2000s, I mean, I have seen some of the worst offshoot bands with famous punks in them. Like really, you're going to... like. There was one that was a punk superstar band, and they were doing their version of Captain Beefheart. And if I saw them one more time, I was going to kill myself. And no, I wasn't.
They don't do shows there anymore. They replaced it with pool tables. I played there with Conan Neutron and the Secret Friends. I played guitar with
Conan. They were doing some shows there for a while, but it's like the hot place is the Permanent Records Roadhouse down there that I took you to that one time.
Yeah. Should we do our next LA live show there? Is that what you're saying? We should do our next LA live show there?
You should. And they had a, I mean, it's like people are, it's still happening in Highland Park, you know? It's, just because I left doesn't mean it fell apart.
it was even nicer than it was when I was there, I guess it was 2018, 2019. Uh-huh. I played a show with Conan. And it was a nice spot.
It's one of those things where people are telling me to say they're all using the Yogi Berra quote. Nobody goes there anymore. It's too crowded. You know, it's like nobody.
It's expensive. Dude, it was expensive. To bowl for the hour, it was like $75 an hour. The lanes, okay, just to let you guys know, I used to bowl competitively as a young person. And my first ever job when I was 11 was keeping score at Uptown Bowl in Richmond, California, which sadly no longer exists.
My first job.
Yeah, at 11 o'clock at night, I'd walk in a very dangerous city. My mom gave no fucks. And, you know, I made, like $30 a night or something like that. Anyway, I bowl, right? I'm serious about my bowling. I've never seen lanes like that in my life. I don't think they oil them at all. I think they said, fuck it. When I would throw the ball,
it's not really a bowling alley.
And I was like offended because there's like lane etiquette and stuff like that you learn. So I was like, okay, there's no lane etiquette. I get that. But I've never seen divots. There were divots in the fucking lane.
No, it's not a real bowling alley. It's to go It's to go with your like hipster friends and pay $30. There was no 16-pound
balls there.
No.
So I'm like, why am I using a child's bowling ball?
The saddest one was when the Hollywood Lanes like got turned into, they made it a school, which when the school district, they took out all the best bowling alleys, and a lot of us thought it was a conspiracy, but the Hollywood Lanes where they did Big Lebowski.
Yeah.
That was like, we actually had a protest there trying to stop it from being turned into a school. And he was a big star at the time, but what's his face from 24? Kiefer Sutherland came with his kids. And at the end, we had another one at the end where everybody they gave us all the bowling pins.
Well,
one of my exes has a bowling pin.
If anybody wants to go bowling in LA at Highland Park Bowl, I am down. It has to be on a Sunday.
I will tell you one of my biggest regrets. One summer when I was working at Conley Water Ski in my hometown of Linwood, Washington, this friend of mine and I, we were listening to the radio, and it was after their first record, and Def Leppard, anybody who wanted to go bowling with Def Leppard could go to this bowling alley. And apparently only two people went. We were going to ditch work, and then we thought better of it. We just didn't want to get in trouble. And it was like a summer job for me, but it's like, we should have gone down and bowled with Def Leppard. Dude,
you could have definitely bowled with Def Leppard.
Yeah, it was after like that first record, and like nobody gave a shit who they were. They were probably opening for somebody.
Oh, and, On Through the Night's the first record, right?
Yeah.
Ooh.
I'd probably still be buddies with Joe Elliott now.
I want and photograph Sean Moon is not on the first record. That is on Pyromania.
Yes. That's on the third record.
Come on, dude. On Through the Night, brother. That's the truck going to the triangle thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Go pull it up on your freaking Spotify or whatever. Whatever you're listening to,
you know,
it is there. Go listen to Def Leppard.
There's nothing before wrong Phil with Collins. The early Def Leppard, and there's nothing right about anything they did after 87.
we're going to talk some Def Leppard next Tuesday, guys. Don't worry. That's my 1984 punk and metal show. Sean says, so sorry. I'm effing with you, dude. I'm totally effing with you.
By the way, do you know Weapon of Choice? Not Weapon of Choice, Mother's Finest.
Yeah. I had their producer one of the on the great
show. Bands of all time.
I had the was producer that? On the show, Tom Worman.
Oh, wow. Yeah, yeah.
Go he back and watch the Tom Worman show. He says that's one of his own. I asked him what his biggest regret is. And this is the guy that discovered Kiss, didn't sign him because the label said, what the fuck is up with the makeup? And I got to make fun of Tom Worman because he met Kiss when they were Wicked Lester. And by the time he brought he was an A&R first. By the time he brings the label owner over to see Wicked Lester, they're like, we broke up Wicked Lester. We got this new thing. It's called Kiss. We wear this makeup. Worman has no idea. They go in, you know, brings the label owner for the audition, and they said they walk out of the room, and the label owner looks at him like, what the fuck was this? Don't you ever bring this shit to me again? And ends up being Kiss.
I never got Kiss. I just didn't.
Sean Moon is so stuck on Pyromania. Sean Moon, I'm telling you, stop quoting Pyromania and Hysteria era. All the Mutt Lang stuff. Leave it there. I'm telling you, go back to when they were trying to be Led Zeppelin, when they were new wave of British heavy metal, Def Leppard, and you're On Through the Night. And what's the second one? High and Dry.
Saturday night,
hi. I'm telling you.
That was actually that in a weird way. That was their breakthrough album because
that was the breakthough. That's with
Well, because MTV played Bring It On the Heart.
Bring It On the Heartbreak. Yeah, that's the single. So
after they did that, the label put more money into them.
Go back, Sean Moon. Sean Moon, look, brother. I'm talking. Look, Shawnee. I'm talking.
But Pyromania is a good record. I mean, it is.
Look, Bill. Look, I'm gonna do this, Bill, because I can't have you interrupt me with this nonsense, Bill. Hold on. I did the wrong person. That's how old I am. Shawnee, I'm talking directly to you right now, Shawnee. Go and listen to early Def Leppard. Okay? I want you then go listen to Whitesnake before 1987. I need you to go do that for me. And then chase that with Rainbow Era Ronnie James Dio. Okay? We're going to just get all this uber synthetic stuff out of your ears, okay? All right, brother. That's all. That's all. Hey, and I'm not saying this because I don't like you. I'm saying this because I appreciate you as a human being. Okay, Shawnee? That's all I want you to know, brother. That's it.
You're not going to make him listen to Paul D'Amato.
He's going to come back. So I found this band Iron called Mott the Hoople.
Oh, I am the biggest Mott the Hoople fan, man. Okay. This is the champagne room, sort of.
This is the
biggest regret of my life. Honest to God, I think this is the biggest regret of my life. My freshman year, there was this young lady, and she it's a long story, but she did something that pissed me off. She lived next door to Mick Ronson and across the street from Ian Hunter. And on Thanksgiving, there was only like 20 of us in the whole dorm. And she wanted me to spend Thanksgiving with her. And I'm a horny 18-year-old, and I stupidly said no.
Why?
Because I was mad at her. And like, who does that?
Oh, Jesus.
Who does that? And not only that, I could have gone like spring break because she didn't live that. She lived in like New York, and I could have gone and met Mick Ronson, Ian Hunter. Like, what an idiot.
Fucking
who up, does dude. That? You got to be a real stupid young 18-year-old.
You know,
to do that.
You know who does that? The person that can't get over fucking Mutt Lang era Def Leppard. That's what does that goofy ass shit. That's some fucking. That's some fucking trickster ass.
Mick Ronson, I think, is the greatest rock guitarist of all time.
Well, wow. You heard it here first.
He's just so cool, and the way he plays and everything like that. He's fantastic.
Well, I'm going to bring you on one of these music shows that Conan and I are doing, going over these 15 years of the greatest years ever of music.
So are you doing 84?
Already did it.
Oh, you already did it? Did you do
it? Well, Conan did it. I was gone. I had to go see family up north. And I'm doing, he didn't do metal and punk justice. So I'm doing next Tuesday, I'm doing the metal and punk of 1984. There's a lot of good metal and punk in 84.
Yes, there is. And it depends on how you're going to classify punk, but did he throw in Meat Puppets too? Is 84?
Yeah, actually, Meat Puppets is on. So I don't know if you know this.
Is Double Nickels 84? Nickels on a Dime.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep. That's on the playlist. I make a playlist, and I made two separate playlists this time. We've done three of these shows: 1979, 1993, and now 1984. So there's a Spotify playlist.
Okay.
Of over 100 releases, one song of each release in no particular order.
Do you consider the Replacements punk? Isn't that Let It Be is 84?
Let It Be is 84. Conan talked about Let It Be. Yeah, they're on the punk and metal playlist. I put all that stuff on there, and I'm going to classify it as punk and metal. For me, it's just heavy music. That's why I'm doing it all together. I don't really have demarcating lines. It was all contraband in my house growing up. I wasn't supposed to listen to the devil's music or quote unquote white people shit.
Oh, so you could listen to Mother's Finest.
I might have gotten away with that. I mean, for me, there's a lot of guitar music in funk. Funk is really guitar music to me, especially like Isley Brothers stuff and Parliament Funkadelic Brothers.
Well, the Johnson. Isley Brothers, they're the Beatles of funk, if you ask me.
Oh, dude. I think they're kind of underrated on the guitar end.
Oh, so, Ernie's amazing, you know.
I love a lot of that stuff. It was inspirational to me.
Go back and watch them do Fight the Power on Soul Train.
Mm-hmm.
And they are big boys, right? And they're wearing these outfits, and the girls are just all just going crazy as they're singing Fight the Power. And you don't have to be a skinny rock star to get the chicks. You can be an Isley brother.
Oh, well, so you say.
Go back and watch them on Soul
Train.
I've been
to LA a lot, and when I go there, there's some skinny, waifish motherfuckers with some women that can't fit their pants.
Well, they're not Isley brothers, though.
No, and neither am I.
What's amazing about that people don't talk about is like the Isleys and James Brown and a couple other people, like they started in the church and went all the way through funk.
Mm-hmm.
Like they reinvented themselves like five times and changed music, you know, two or three times, those bands, you know. And let's face it, if James Brown wasn't cheap, there'd be no Parliament Funkadelic.
Oh, God bless him. You know, guy, hey, that's what I say. Bootsy and his brother. What those cats did for music is so criminally underrated. I'm writing this article. It's pretty much a preface to this book I'm working on with Alex Herbert. And I'm talking so much about music that influenced me when I was a young person. Mm-hmm. And when I was young, I lived with my grandmother, and she had a nephew of hers living in the house that was much older. He's like 70 something now, crazy alcoholic, but he went to all the shows. He went to all the shows back in the day, and he still went to all the shows. So he would make tapes for me as like an 11-year-old. I was like, hey,
nice.
I want to get into this punk music. And he was like, stop right there. I'll make you a tape. And it was local bands, of course, because I'm from the Bay Area. So Flippers on there and you know, Psychofunkapuss is on there. And early Primus is on there. Because that stuff used to come on college radio.
Right.
Clash was on there. Of course, the Kennedys was on there. And he would just expose me all this crazy ass music and tell me about these concerts. And you know, Fishbone for me was another one of those bands.
Oh, Fishbone's the greatest. I've been talking about them because they, you know, Henry Selick did a video with them.
Okay, didn't know that.
And there's a whole thing in my book because so Henry did it was for Party at Ground Zero.
Ooh, Party at Ground Zero.
And he did a video, and our friend John Pohl, who's a doctor in anthropology at UCLA, he had a bunch of vintage hats.
Mm-hmm.
And Fish, the old drummer, he stole the hat. So John Pohl and I were going around Hollywood looking for Fish, and we couldn't find him. And then one of the other guys gave us tickets to one of the greatest shows I've ever seen because we couldn't find Fish and get his hat back. I don't think we ever got the hat back, but it was Fishbone opened, followed by the Chili Peppers.
Mm-hmm.
Midway through the Chili Peppers set, this is when they still had Hillel.
Mm-hmm.
George Clinton came out and joined.
Wow. And this is when Clinton produced that one record for him.
Yeah. And then about two-thirds of the way through, the Fishbone guys came out. And then they started wrestling over the microphone, and it was just complete chaos on stage, but it was incredible. And the closing act, and they held the stage, was Run DMC.
Wow. Where was this in LA?
It was at the Palladium. And it's one of the greatest shows I've ever seen. Every band was spot on. And Run DMC, you know, I saw them like, 15 years later, and it wasn't the same. I mean, they controlled the stage. And then they came back like 4 months later, and it was the Beastie Boys opening for them at the Palladium. And,
was this 1986? Was it about 86?
It was 85 and 86. The first show was in 85. The second one was 86. And then what happened was they had that show at Long Beach Arena with the shooting. And basically, they didn't let rap bands.
Very hard for rap to tour in the 80s.
Yeah, they wouldn't let them tour in LA.
Nobody would give them a permit to do. There was going to be a rap concert down the street from my house. I live down the street from the Richmond Civic Auditorium. Very small place. And it was going to be LL Cool J, MC Light, and somebody else. And before the show even got started, we were bad little kids that just ride our bikes around there trying to just get in for free. And before the show even started, and this is literally the auditorium is connected to the police station. Literally.
Wow.
They shot it. They shot it up.
You're show kidding. Never happened.
Show couldn't even happen. I mean, well, it was a different
people forget
time.
LL Cool J was the biggest act in rap right after Run DMC.
Oh, by far.
And by far.
You still don't understand. What does Tucson always say? He's got that line in Jingling Baby. He goes, Uncle L, Future of the Funk. And she goes, how you going to be an uncle and a future? Like, whose uncle is a future or anything?
It's like, I respect that he's had a long career and probably has a couple nice houses. But when I see him now, like on net, you know, some of those TV shows he does, I'm just like, oh, dude, you're LL Cool J.
He's still in great shape. You know, I don't care if he's on roids. He's still got to lift weights.
He's LL Cool J, and we're not, baby.
He's the future of the funk. Uncle L. Uncle L. Future of the funk. Funniest, when Toussaint pointed that out, I couldn't stop laughing. There was like tears just streaming down my eyes thinking about that, and I kept playing that song over and over. But
no, are we not paying attention to the chat here?
I'm trying not to. You know, gaze into the abyss. I don't know if they're good. Chat, are you guys? Well, look, Saturday's show is a very important show. And
what is Saturday?
We're going to be talking about Western Sahara.
Really?
Yeah, with Bill Fletcher Jr.
That sounds interesting.
Oh.
Is that the one that's
still a colony?
Still fighting over?
Yep, it's the only colony left in Africa.
Wow.
Yeah, Morocco. So it's going
to
be.
But they were supposed to have a. Weren't they supposed to have a? Election to see if Morocco got to keep it, or did that not
it's still occupied from my understanding, and we're going to talk about that with Bill. Pascal's excited about it, so it's
well, that's some crazy stuff. And I'll be honest with you, like when all that stuff went down last year, and it's weird because I love a lot of music from that area, but the stuff with Niger and with Burkina Faso. I did not know that when the French gave them their independence, it didn't involve the monetary system, and that France has been blood sucking those countries for years.
Forever. And you know, Pascal being Haitian has a certain hatred for France and the way they treat Francophone Africa. So it should be an interesting show. You know, there's a hyper focused solo issue right now that sadly gets echoed. Because it's monetarily feasible for certain people to echo it. And it is a real problem, right? What's going on in Israel, Palestine. But there's very similar situations going on throughout the world that no attention whatsoever.
That's the thing is like, what, Haiti's still all tore up again, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like it had like a 2-day, Haiti's blowing up again, and then everybody like looks away, and that's, you know, and Ecuador's got a bunch of stuff going on, and you know, that has to do with the European drug trade, and that's what all that shit went down between Mexico and Ecuador. But they tell me 4 years ago Ecuador was like the safest place in South America, and now it's just overrun with gangs, and it's all because they're shipping coke out of that port, and it all goes to Europe.
No one's talking about El Salvador's president killing everybody. I feel like there was more attention on Duterte in the Philippines when he was doing the same thing.
Right.
Than there is about El Salvador. And I don't know exactly why that is. But I think it also has to do with just kind of hyper focusing on certain developments.
But see, that goes back to what you were saying about before, though, because El Salvador, the people like bring in the cops and lock these people up, you know? When people vote in a strong arm guy, there's usually a reason that they think they're going to get out of it, you know?
Well, you know, the right wing is really loving the El Salvador narrative of, look, they cleaned up their murder rate because they locked everybody up.
Right.
So Connor says, because Duterte was around the same time as Trump. I think so, Connor. That's a good point, that Duterte, Bolsonaro, Trump, Boris Johnson. Who am I forgetting? Erdogan. Who else? All that's around the same time.
But a lot of the stuff that started up in El Salvador was when we started deporting people here.
Oh, yeah. That's a U.S. Phenomenon, right? We caused that problem. And this ain't the way to fix it. But it's the numbers reporting. When you try to find out figures about El Salvador, it's just, it's all real murky. It's real, real murky. About how many people the police are actually killing.
Well, and that's, well, you know, I don't want to go all Jimmy Dore on you, but it is true. But it's been going on for longer than we want to admit. You know, the New York Times, Washington Post, they don't tell us anything that's true at this point. It's gotten just so ridiculous. It used to be you could believe part of what the New York Times said, but
you mean foreign policy wise?
Particularly foreign policy wise, they're much more apt to tell you the truth about what's going on in this country, but they barely do that these days. But foreign policy, it's
mainstream media foreign policy is going to be pretty skewed and horrible,
right?
For the most part, it has been for a minute, in my opinion. Someone says.
I was saying, Jimmy Dore doesn't read.
I don't know anything about Bill. Probably knows more about Jimmy Dore because didn't Jimmy Dore live in your district?
He lives in Pasadena. I think he used to live in the district. The ones who live in the district are the convo couch people, and they were actually friends with a guy that was in my office. You know, it's
they're Jimmy Dore people, aren't they?
I don't think they are anymore. They think they were for a while, and then he's kicked them to the curb for those dude dissidents guys.
I don't know what you're talking about right now, and I'm so glad.
It's okay. You know, he's just like, I get stuff in my feed. But, I mean, now that I have Columbia Radio and it's nonstop protest and Ella Fitzgerald, I won't be listening to anything else.
My feed is filled with horror movies and movies I didn't know existed. Since this is some Champagne Room stuff, I did not know that there was a sequel to the movie Samurai Cop.
I did not know that either.
And it was made in 2015, and you can watch Samurai Cop and the sequel on YouTube. No commercials.
Wow.
Just throwing that out there for people that know anything about the awesomeness of bad movies. Samurai Cop 2, not very good, but Samurai Cop, it is the most accidentally hilarious film you've ever seen in your life.
Okay, this is not a bad film. This is actually a great film. Have you ever seen Swordsman 2 with Jet Li?
No.
Swordsman 2, okay. These are some of the greatest experiences of my life. I was up in Seattle getting ready to move back to L.A., and they used to have this place called the Seven Gables. It was in a house, and they used to have actual milkshakes at a movie theater where the screen was really small, and they showed this movie called Swordsman 2, where and it's based off a Chinese folktale where this emperor is going to get all powerful and they won't be able to stop him if he's able to convert from being a man to being a woman.
Okay.
And Jet Li is getting divorced from his wife. She's dumping him and he's got a sister. And they're all in love with him, including the emperor, who's about to make the completion over, and she's in love with Jet Li as well. And they end up in a battle royale with flying through the air. It's the craziest thing. They're all mad at him, but two of them are fighting with him, and it's just battle royale for 20 minutes. So I'm watching this thing. It's fantastic. And I call, this is when they were doing Nightmare Before Christmas.
Oh, wow.
And I call down there and I go like, oh my God, this is the greatest movie ever. You guys got to find this movie. And it's like, I was talking to Joe Ramp and Henry Selick, and they're like, what's it called? And I'm like, it's called Swordsman 2. And so they found it in San Francisco. And Henry came back and he loved it so much. He did a whole bunch of he did a bunch of stuff where Jack Skellington and those guys were flying around. And Tim came in and saw what he was doing and just lost his nut. And they got in a fist fight.
It's good to know that Tim Burton is about that life.
And when Joe Ramp, the great, great Joe Ramp, was telling me about it, I said, what does that look like? And he goes, like a couple of middle-aged men flailing for 60 seconds and then both falling in a crumple of heaving and gasping. And I was like, sounds about right.
I would love
But that this movie was so great. And there is a Swordsman 3, but Jet Li's not in it. And yes, Jet Li is probably 60 plus now.
Easily.
But back in the day, Jet Li, those early, that was a Choi Hark movie, if I'm not mistaken. Kush
looks at, that's just Planet Fitness. I want to play you this clip since this is all free champagne. So enjoy the free champagne, everybody. In the champagne room, we watch clips of things that I find on the internet. I found this clip of, I think it's a Disney show. I don't know what the name of the show is. Maybe Power Rangers or something. But I think what this is a hate crime. This is the equivalent of the N-word. What you're going to see, to me, is the equivalent of the N-word and must be stopped. Here you go. But we don't want to get banned. Look at that! Look at that kid's hairline! Look at that kid's goddamn hairline!
What the hell?
How dare you do this to this young black child? This hairline is such a hate crime. And so, Bill, people roasted this. He's a man now. And he responded to the roasts.
What did he say?
He was like, he didn't know. First of all, he's like, I assumed the Disney, and it's his verified account. He's like, I assumed the Disney barber knew what they were doing.
And what year was that?
Oh, this is like 91, 92. But just look at this poor kid's hairline. This is racial violence. I don't care what anyone says. This is what Martin fought for. He fought for, you know,
did not have a haircut.
Kushlick says, when barbers fake it till they make it. Can you imagine how white you have to be as a barber to see a young black kid come into the chair and you just have a panic attack? Like, how?
I do think that's a hate crime. And,
people just went in, and he replied to most people's comments.
That's the Black Ranger, Walter Jones.
It's a Black Power Ranger. Yeah. This isn't a Power Ranger thing. It's like a Disney thing, because he said it was Disney and he just assumed that the Disney barber knew how to cut hair. To give you an idea, Walter Jones says, this is actually from his page. In the 90s, when you tell the set hairstylist to line you up and he has no idea how to do black hair. And he says, hashtag boomer.
Wow.
Somebody says, as far as I'm concerned, that hairline meant you were the most well-rounded actor on set.
Wow. Well, I'm going to have nightmares tonight, but I think on that note, I think we should call it a wrap.
I think we should call it a night. It's been 2 hours and 42 minutes. I am Sabonka. No, somebody said I am Sabonka.
Wow.
They said preceding him. Bill, thank you so much for hanging out with me.
Hey, thank you. And I hope you all had fun, and we'll do it again soon.
You guys will be back Saturday with Bill Fletcher and the whole TIR crew, or just the main black people. The DEI crew will not be with us. Just the main black people. So thank you, Bill, so much. And let's have some mellow cartoons on the way out. Don't tell me anything about the draft. We are out.